Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Queer Quadrant, a podcast where we, two bisexual filmmakers, examine cinema in all its cultural contexts and explore why your favorite four-quadrant blockbuster is maybe not as straight as you think it is.
You know what's cool about this movie and sort of, you know, Steven Spielberg is that in an era of directors making movies about their own lives, you know, you have Belfast, you know, Licorice Pizza, you could kind of go through them, you know,
Bardo.
Bardo, sure. Steven Spielberg didn't decide to do that, and he made one about our greatest queer filmmaker, Sammy Fableman. So he didn't tell a story about his own life. He told one about just a queer icon and legend. And I really think that's brave of him to do.
I'm just going to get this out of the way quickly. Emily, I don't know if you saw this short, and I'm pretty positive that you did, but there was one point during this award season when Steven Spielberg went up to and accept an award about the Fablemans, and he was being very personal and emotional and saying, "This is unlike any movie I've ever made, and I just want to say it's been a very long time coming because," and then said something wonderful about, like, "This is my family and the power of cinema and all that good stuff." And I saw a quote tweet that was like, "I fully thought Steven Spielberg was about to come out as bisexual at the age of 78 or however old he is." And I was like, "In what world would you think that?" And then I rewatched the Fablemans and I was like, "You know?
Sammy Fableman a little, huh?"
Listen, I he is our greatest living queer filmmaker.
He is.
Everything about this movie, and I'm sure we'll dig into this more, is like, I just imagine the writing process. The writing process was Spielberg and Tony Kushner on Zoom, and Spielberg would just share stories from his life, and they'd like talk about how that could be turned into a movie scene. And I just imagine every story Spielberg shared, Kushner was like, "Really? You sure about that, buddy? You got some stuff you want to talk about?" And Spielberg was like, "I want to tell you about John Ford." So...
yep.
And there's absolutely no homoerotic subtext to anything at all.
Absolutely none.
That is about how I think it went.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Today we're talking about the power of cinema. Like, we have never talked about the power of cinema before. I'm Brooke Solomon.
Jordan Gustafson.
Today we are discussing Steven Spielberg's 2022 magnum opus, The Fablemans, and we are joined by Emily St. James, writer, podcaster, co-host of podcast like it's 1992 most of the time, and an all-around wonderful person. Lovely to have you here.
It's great to be here. I'm so sorry I don't do the Patreon, but Phil was like, "Do you want to come on for the Taylor Swift episode with Brooke?" And I was like, "Yes, I do." And then we couldn't make it work. But
I'm gonna
so
be back.
Sorry.
I'm gonna be back. Don't you worry.
Let's all go to the Eras tour together and record from there.
Well,
let's
I would like to announce on mic that we will be going together.
We have secured the bag. Jordan and I have nosebleed tickets to the Friday show here in LA.
I was recently laid off and I got a severance, and like, we were looking on SeatGeek, and front row tickets to the LA shows right now are like $7,000, which is way too much. I would never pay that much. And I was like, I have this severance money, and I've kind of transitioned to
You're
freelancing.
Like, what if?
And I was like, what if I did this? And I was like, no, but then she would see me.
Yes. Like, you would that have was, to be like, perceived by Taylor.
The fact that I could not afford that and I should be like frugal right now was second after she might see me.
That is so funny.
It's crazy though, because I have fallen deep into the Eras Tour TikTok and Twitter spaces. There are full videos of her waving at people in the audience and doing these little smiles and winks. And I really don't think that I could survive it.
No.
So I'm with you.
It's like... yeah, you know what I often think of when you think of like artists like seeing people in the crowd is that Lady Gaga video where she like turns and like stares at the person recording,
yes,
and it is horrifying.
Oh.
Like, I feel like that is what would happen with me, and I would die.
I think that she would look at me and immediately grab the microphone and say, "I just want to say, this has been a wonderful tour. I've done so many great things," and then there'd be a long pause, and she would like to say, "This is so personal to me. I am bisexual." And I would be like, "Thank you."
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
You,
the power of cinema.
Emily, you as an individual would change the course of human and Swiftie history.
Exactly.
I'd believe it.
With
I'd
that front row ticket.
And she would be like, yes, I'm in a committed long-term relationship with a man whom I love. But you know what? That does not erase my queerness as a human.
That's
and
so
I would
true.
Be like, thank you, Taylor.
Glad ally of the year, Taylor
Same.
Swift.
Same. Me being in a long-term committed relationship with a woman doesn't erase the part of me that thinks boys are cute.
I have a question for the Taylor fans, because obviously Taylor Swift, you know, she was hitting the ground this award season for All Too Well, the short film. Is it a short film? Is it not?
It is
up for
short
conversation.
Film.
She obviously would have seen this movie. Do we think Taylor liked this film or not?
I think she
did. Or
did
she even make it through the whole thing?
I think she watched it and she liked it. But I don't think she loved it.
I think Taylor Swift is a surprisingly smart cinephile. Mm-hmm. I think that she wasn't always, but I think it does feel to me like her pandemic thing was she just bought the entire Criterion Collection and was like, I'm just going to watch all of this. And if Joe wants to join, he can.
Sure.
And then, you know, they work their way through it. Like, one of my favorite, like, there's a good, a pretty good Lena Dunham movie that came out last year called Sharp Stick. And yeah. Taylor Swift is thanked in the credits. And Lena wow. Dunham was like, I got some great notes from Taylor. And I'm like, Lena... Like,
interesting.
Lena just like dropping that name when she can, even though they're friends. I'm just like, listen, if I were friends
it's
with
a
Taylor
humble
Swift,
brag.
I would never talk about it. I would come on this podcast and you would say Taylor Swift and I'd be like,
who?
She's a recording artist, right? I've heard of her.
Never heard of her.
You gotta gatekeep your famous friendships. It's important.
I don't know. I wonder if there's like a person, like if it is like that big, do you just become like is that like the bit? You're like, I'm friends with Taylor Swift. I'm sorry. Like, it's true. I feel like I would
I have a person I know somewhat well. Like, we're not friends, but like if we see each other at a party, we say hi and talk for,
sure.
you know, 15 minutes. I consider myself friendly with them. I'm not going to say who it is because for a long time, like, I would drop that name and I just felt like such a piece of shit doing
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
You know, but someday I hope to have him on a podcast and then I will drop that name.
There
That's
we
the
go.
Reveal. Honestly, yeah. yeah you don't say it and then they guest on the pod.
It's all about monetizing your famous friendship for personal gain, but
That's
only
true.
In the podcasting sphere. Mm-hmm. You know, it's this, classier than name dropping.
Yes. This extremely famous, multiple award winning artist who, you know, has been nominated for everything under the sun, won everything under the sun, has got to come on and do the Beethoven app of 92. He's just got to do it.
That's
got to happen.
Easy layup done.
Now we'll know. Listener, eagle-eared listeners.
I'm seeing
keep an
here,
eye out.
Steven Spielberg on Beethoven.
Here's the thing, though. I am pretty positive that Taylor Swift liked this movie because she's in her directing era. She's directing a movie
course,
for
sure.
Searchlight. She's like in her cinephile.
Right. She was taking notes on
era.
This. She was like, let's study the blocking.
Yeah. So she was like, yeah, the magic of movies. Mm-hmm. I guarantee she took that
for
horizon
sure.
line
oh.
to heart.
There's not going to be one shot in that movie that has the horizon in the middle.
We're going to see.
We're
going to find
down,
out.
We're up. We're panning. Nothing.
We're
yeah.
going to find out.
Is she Janusz, I heard, is going to shoot that, right? It's just going to be Pools of Light by Taylor.
We'll see.
No, I was hanging out with a friend the other day, and she hates Janusz Kaminski. That's like her thing, like, is hating Janusz Kaminski. And outside, it's been raining in L.A., but the rain had sort of lifted and the light was very soft and golden as it fell on the street. And she was like, look at this. Look at this. This looks like Janusz Kaminski shot it. I hate it.
I think
Damn.
This is a good running bit to have.
What
I really
like
this. What did
Janusz ever do to her?
I do think that this is going to be the whole episode. It's just believing Sammy Fableman is a real person, because in my heart of hearts, he is. Like, there is Steven Spielberg and there is Sammy Fableman.
Yeah.
There is not one and the same.
Yeah, and Sammy Fableman works with all the same people.
Of course,
so, like,
yeah.
they just alternate between Spielberg projects and Fableman projects.
Yeah.
And it's just like, they travel between the worlds. And
right.
we just, you know, we didn't know it, but Janusz is like a multiverse traveler. He's
That's
like...
True.
He's like Evelyn from Everything Everywhere All at Once, which defeated this film at the Oscars. And you
it
know
did.
What?
We will get
That's
into
fine.
That.
It's
That's fine.
The Fablemans.
That's good. Good for them.
Walked away empty-handed, which I'm a little.
I'm upset about actually.
About. But yeah. but that yeah. being said, when I look at all of the awards that it was up for, I'm pretty happy with
sure.
the winners. So I don't know that I'm like
mad.
This specific person was robbed.
I think it's just more fascinating the arc and trajectory the movie had upon like the debut at TIFF and then sort of its award season run and kind of the fact that it was such a front runner to begin with what people thought and then how it just slowly faded.
in some ways it feels like it was too perfect of a frontrunner.
I think we can talk about this a little bit. I've been thinking about the movies that won. I was not the world's biggest Everything Everywhere fan. I think it's a great winner because I think it's like a really good exploration of the year of cinema. People adored that movie. Like that over, I liked Banshees of Inisherin about the same as that movie, but like that would be a much more boring winner than Everything Everywhere All at Once. That said, if I could flip one of its seven Oscars to something else, I would flip original screenplay to Tar or to this. And I'd rather that something else had won screenplay and then it had won the other six. That would have been great. Good for them. Good. I also would flip supporting actress to Stephanie Hsu, but she's in the same fucking movie, so it doesn't matter.
Right.
We're aligned on that one.
I think we all are. I would flip director to Stevie. I think that this movie, like the rewatch, like I guess the first watch, we'll get into like our watches, but like it's sort of like that thing you watch and you soak it in. But this rewatch, just picking up on, like, it's not a hot take that Steven Spielberg is a good director. We all know that. But just seeing the directorial flourishes and then listening to how he made it and how so much of it was just on set is sort of mind boggling. Like when someone's brain is that talented, it's just unbelievable. And I think that's what this movie is so fascinating about, is just like the burden of also thinking that way, of being Steven Spielberg and being a filmmaker, and the way that art like impacts the way in which you see everything, like good, bad,
movies are a curse.
Exactly.
Movies are a gift, but movies are also a curse.
Yeah.
Also the theme of Babylon.
Yes.
That's true.
Damien Chazelle's 2022 masterpiece.
Are you pro Babel? Do you like to Babylon?
I'm fucking pro Babylon. And I will, if you want to call it Babel and you're going to like say it's great, then I'm going to find good. You do what you got to do. But like, I love it.
I am okay on that movie, but I will say I have been, I do like the Hello College. I think that scene
so
is
good.
Incredible.
I'm Switzerland so on this movie. I still haven't seen it. Incredible. I'll get to it. I promise.
Listen, by the end of this podcast, you're both going to be Babylon fans. You won't even have seen it, Brooke, but you'll be like, I'm in favor of this movie.
Okay.
Also, I like coming on here because this is the one show that lets me be as chaotic as I actually am.
What?
We got it. By the end of this podcast, we got to talk about John Wick and if those movies are queer at all. Because I tend to find queerness in everything. And I watch John Wick and I'm like, outside of the fact that everybody's really hot, I'm not sure it's there. Like, everybody's kind of androgynous. It's got a Matrix thing going on, but it's like a super straight version of the Matrix. Don't entirely understand it. But Rina Sawayama. I had no idea who the fuck she was until I saw this fourth movie. Yeah. I'd heard her name. Because I'm like, I know pop music stands. Yeah. But like, I had never listened to any of her music or anything like that. She pops up in the movie and I'm like, who the fuck is that? Yeah. And then like, she like strips down to like a tactical dress that's just like made out of leather. And I'm like, who the fuck is that? She's great. Fantastic. Would die for her. Still think this movie's like even that. Weirdly straight. We're gonna have to talk about it.
I think like
John Wick straight.
We have the third one, I think, on our long list.
The third one is probably the queerest if we're trying to rank them, because we have Asia Kate Dillon as with the inspector. Which is very cool.
These
and
names.
I think that like Halle Berry and the dogs, it's giving like a little dom top. You know, there's, I think that the third one is where you can make the best argument, but I would agree with you, Emily, in that it feels like because the movies bother to be stylish and have neon and like actually have elegance to them, they have to then make up for that by being like deeply heterosexual. There, it's missing the homoeroticism of, say, like the Bond franchise.
The queerness of them is almost entirely in, every time John Wick is killing people in a club, a thing he does in every movie, people just keep dancing. It's like, that's how it would be. I guess, you know, I'm sure there are people who write like elaborate, you know, ship things.
Of course.
You know, AO3 or whatever. And like, there are like undertones of the relationship between McShane and Reddick has some tenderness to it that feels like a long-term marriage. But that's just two people who've worked together forever.
Right.
Like, I don't know. There's just not, and the villains are all kind of cosmopolitan, which often is queer coded, and it's just, I don't know.
Like Alfie
I love
Allen.
Those movies. I think they are the straightest movies being made right now.
It's just not quite giving. I think like his Bond, it feels like a good one-to-one. There's a lot of respect and fear for John Wick, but there's not a lot of attraction for John Wick. And I think for most action, especially male-driven action movies, it's all about like appreciation of the form of the central guy.
Yeah, you need like someone looking at Bond and being like, Mr. Bond, I will kill you, but also hunka hunka.
Yes.
Like Daniel Craig coming out of the beach water. I agree. I think it's just like, I've never had like a queer feeling watching those movies, but I guess I have not seen the fourth one yet. So I guess I was going to see it this evening. Reveal for those peeking behind the curtain.
The fourth one is probably my favorite. It's truly excellent. It got such great reviews, and I was like watching the first. It's a fucking almost 3 hour long movie. I was like watching the first hour and a half, and I was like, this is good. This is fun. This is a John Wick movie. I like John Wick movies. And then just the last hour is just absurd. It's just like so much. And like it has so much action, and then the concluding set piece has a sort of great deal of emotion to it, which is was surprising to me. It's wonderful. It's beautiful. And my new fave Rena is just like so good in it. Donnie Yen's amazing. Like it's just a showcase for so many great action performers. So like I can't begrudge it on any level, but it is very straight. It is very much a movie about a guy whose wife died and then his puppy died, and he's like, I'm gonna fucking kill the world. And I'm like, I love that for you, John Wick, but also it is a little bit heteronormative.
It's a little falling down.
It's feeling it. I'm actually shocked though, because Rina Sawayama is, well, I wouldn't say she's a gay icon in the way that Lady Gaga is a gay icon, since Lady Gaga is bisexual. And I don't actually know how Rina Sawayama identifies sexuality-wise. But let me just say, her music reminds me so much of that, just like, this is music for gay people.
Queer people, yes.
Like, yeah, I listened to a bunch of it last
year.
Yes. Night. I was like, oh, okay.
I'm Charlie XCX core.
Yes, that's the best way to describe it. Charlie XCX core. I'm obsessed with her. I was going to go see her in November, but she was playing Thanksgiving weekend in Los Angeles. A weekend in which there's usually nobody here in Los Angeles. So I did not get to see her. I was too busy getting engaged. But I will see her soon.
Humble brag. Wait, so it actually went well for you, though, unlike Sammy Fableman. He proposed, he was dumped.
You're going to drag us back on topic, and
I will.
I'm gonna go there eventually. But I just want to say that if Rina Sawayama was in the front row at Taylor Swift's Eras tour, Taylor would take one look at her and be like, you know, tour has been so.
She doesn't even say that. She just says, I'm bi. Congrats. You won. Charlie Kloss had nothing on you.
Charlie Kloss?
Right?
Carly Kloss.
Oh, Carly, whatever.
Carly
God.
With a K.
Look, I'm not that deep in there. I'm getting there. Since the last time, Emily, we spoke on this pod, I have gone from like Taylor Swift listener to fan, because we have had a new album release since that time. And so I've been converted.
Jordan is fully in Swiftie land. I'm very proud of this.
This is all your fault.
And your sister.
That's true.
And work. So it's it's a multi-pronged effort. But we were not only able to get tickets and then sell tickets, because we had them for a day when I wasn't going to be in town. But then we got worse, but still got the tickets for the day that we wanted.
Yeah, I would say it was a Herculean effort by us. Yeah.
Yeah. So hopefully we'll see you there. And hopefully we'll see your 1992 pod cast co-host Phyllis Gove there as well. I mean, we better.
Yeah, we should get all the LA podcasters there. Just like have the Doughboys hanging out in one of the VIP boxes. I hear the Doughboys are opening for her, actually.
Oh, I heard that too. Yeah, they're talking about McDonald's finally. They're going to do it.
You would not believe the intersection of fandom between Doughboys and Taylor Swift.
I'm sure it's huge.
If you dig deep, I mean, it's truly incredible. Okay.
Anyways, do you think Sammy Fableman will be there? I heard Sammy Fableman's a huge Taylor Swift fan.
Okay, but like, you know, again, the lyricism, you know, the storytelling?
His doppelganger, Steven Spielberg, was at the Haim show that I went to at the Hollywood Bowl. So I'm guessing that, yes. I'm thinking that if Spielberg's a fan of Haim, then Fableman's a fan of Taylor Swift.
It's
so,
a clear one-to-one, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he'll be there front row. And the thing about Sammy Fableman is he's always 19. He's just all, you know, he exists perpetually 19.
Yeah.
It's a little creepy. It's a little Count Saint Germain. But you know what? It's great.
It works for him. I actually did hear a bad thing, though, that he bought a lot of Taylor Swift tickets and sold them at an upcharge. So it was a little problematic, but like we're not going to cancel him for that.
Well, maybe we do need to cancel Sammy Fableman.
I don't know.
The thing is, because
he's brought us so much good queer art,
this movie is a period piece. Sammy Fableman does not get to experience what it's like to be canceled on Twitter.
That's true.
I think that really, if we're talking about queer filmmakers, that's something that he needs to experience to really be included in that canon.
Okay. Do you think if Sammy Fableman was making movies today, because he is still, obviously, but like if Sammy was directing Bros, do you think that the discourse around Bros would have been the same if Sammy Fableman was behind the lens?
Well, you know, he brings like an element of prestige, an element of art appreciation that Bros was maybe missing.
Okay, sure. So. Yeah.
You remember how in Fableman's famous, like his breakout feature Claws, which is about those guys hunting the mountain lion, you know, the enormous mountain lion.
And they couldn't
show it because they didn't really have a good mountain lion. So they had to kind of cut around it.
Right.
So they had that scene of the three guys in the cabin, and it's just fucking charged with like this homoerotic tension.
Mm-hmm.
And they discuss the ways in which Stonewall was a riot.
Yeah.
And then they're like, you know, talking about the importance of queer intersectionality among, you know, all different queer identities
and like
racial groups and genders and things like that. And then, you know, they just start making out, and then the fucking mountain lion like howls outside. So they have to go take care of that.
Of course.
That's like, I can't believe people didn't read that as queer at the time.
No, it was crazy.
And it's all
that's
just about
up.
The practical effects. And it's like, look, I get it. It's very impressive, but shouldn't we be talking about what's actually going to stand the test of time here?
Right, right. And in Far Encounters of the Third Kind, you know, so much of that movie was about the distance between these two men, and people didn't read that the distance was them not being able to get over their internalized homophobia be able to love each other.
What we're realizing here is that while technically every Steven Spielberg movie is about his parents' divorce, every single Sammy Fableman movie is about his burgeoning bisexuality.
Absolutely, yes. No, that's correct.
Well, great, guys. Podcast over. I think we solved the power of cinema
100%,
once and for all.
I love this. West Side Story was not about Romeo and Juliet lovers. It was about Mike Feist and
Ansel.
Ew.
We actually have West Side Story on the QQ long list, though.
Fableman's East Side Story was about Mike Feist and Alden Ehrenreich, who was cast in that. I always get him and Ansel confused because they have the same initials and weird names. It's Alden Ehrenreich and Mike Feist. Non-problematic.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of kissing. People still didn't read it as queer. It was very strange.
It was shocking. They were fucking on screen and people still didn't get it. They were like, look, they're just friends. They're just hanging out. They're really close pals.
Now I really do wish that Alden Ehrenreich was just plastered on billboards all over Los Angeles last year instead of having to drive past Ansel Elgort's face day after day.
I will say, though.
Wonderful.
That kid deserves a break. Alden,
he does. Yeah.
I think Alden got a lot of shit for Solo, which was not his fault. Alden Ehrenreich, innocent. Let's bring him back. Bring him back, Sammy.
Like a nice kid.
He's coming back. He has two movies this year, Fair Play and Cocaine Bear.
I'm ready for Fair Play to really make him pop also, because I just, you know, it is sexy and that's exciting for me, especially for a guy who like Reese is like kind of a sweetheart.
Yeah.
He's a little scumbummy in it.
Yeah. Anyways, The Fablemans, directed by Steven Spielberg, is about Sammy Fableman.
It's a biopic.
A perfect movie. I love it. No notes.
Was it your number one of last year?
It was my number one of last year. It is in, I think, my top five Spielbergs. I can tell you, I've now seen every Spielberg film.
Have you really?
I have.
What was the last one that you had to crack? Is it his like one bad one?
It was, I can tell you. We're vamping as I pull up my list. The last Steven Spielberg movie I saw was Always.
That's one of the shit ones.
Yeah.
33 of 35.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry, Steven. Really rough. I have The Twilight Zone technically on there, which is the last place one. I don't know if we want to count that as just him, but I did.
But his sequence in that movie is pretty bad. So like, I'm fine. It's his sentimentality at its worst. Did you watch all the television work? Did you watch like all the TV episodes?
No, I have to watch the TV episodes. I did see like the TV movies or movie, but I have to get to the TV stuff. We'll get
the first episode of Columbo, which he directed,
it's
like
so cool.
F- fantastically directed, and you're like, who did this? And you look it up, and you're like, oh, okay, yeah,
Steven
sure.
Steven Spielberg. And how old was he? Oh, I'm seeing here, 21. Oh, fuck, I'm going to go kill myself.
That and the Indiana Jones episode, like mm-hmm. the one that he directed, right? Yeah. One or two. Yeah.
He did some night galleries. Like, he did some really weird stuff. The Columbo pilot is, I think, the one that feels the most like
curio.
Steven Spielberg, like, becoming himself.
Yeah.
Mm. And, like, it was a huge hit. He got some other work off it, and obviously he you know, he didn't have Sammy Fableman's career, but he did well for himself.
He's no Sammy Fableman.
Who is the Sammy Fableman one-to-one? Obviously Spielberg, but like, if Sammy Fableman was a queer filmmaker, who do we think his career is?
Oh, well,
like, is it a Pedro Almodovar?
That's the thing, is I feel like it can't actually be as queer as Pedro Almodovar. Mm. It has to be someone who's a little more
Rob Marshall.
Yeah, well, but Rob Marshall's such a hack now, which makes me really upset. I'll have to think about it, come back to me, because I think
we can make this the arc.
There is someone out there.
It's like a Todd Haynes,
yeah,
who directed like, because Todd Haynes has had like blockbuster offers before and has turned them down. But it's like a Todd Haynes who made Safe and Velvet Goldmine. He made those two, and then people were like, okay, George Lucas was like, okay, you gotta fucking make the Star Wars prequels, I can't do it.
So
Todd Haynes makes them. They're much better, they're much bigger hits. There probably couldn't have been bigger hits, but they're still big hits.
Yeah.
And it just takes him to a new level, and then he just makes major blockbusters. Like, that's kind of what we have to have.
Okay, yeah. Look, I'm fine with that. That feels like a nice career for Sammy.
I'm happy for him, you know? It's very difficult to, I think, pick a favorite part of this movie. Sure. It is... It is a feat of screenwriting in that it is just a bunch of little vignettes.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a Womb to Tomb biopic, but it feels so lived in and so real. But This is a movie about the power of movies. The scenes that
movies
really like made me the most emotional were Sammy innovating how to do creative stuff in an indie movie.
Yeah,
like punching holes in the film and the little like dirt plank of wood shot thing.
Yeah.
That's the stuff that really had me like choking up in the theater, because I was like, to me, that's what movie making is figuring out and the innovation of being like, this is it's a textured and a layered medium that you can mess around with. And I think that like that is, in my opinion, like the Spielberg magic, and also obviously the Sammy Fableman magic,
of course. But it's the Fableman touch.
That is like my favorite thing about this movie.
I agree with you. I think the thing is like, we can get into it, but like, I feel like this is like, we've talked about like a personal things, but like, it is really upsetting how many things in this like I deeply related to. Obviously, like, there's the filmmaker stuff, but like the personal stuff, the bullying stuff, like the family stuff, like everything in this, like rewatching was like a checklist of like events that had happened in my life and how my brain works, which was like a little upsetting, but also is just like so
cathartic.
Highly rewarding. Yeah, like just the amount of times it was like, as we talked about before we started rolling, like when you talked about League of Their Own, like your cry moments, it was like just check marking like every 5 minutes, crying at like something else, especially then the last 10 minutes, it's just weeping in between like cackling at David Lynch. But yeah, no, I mean, I don't know. I think this movie, because what works so well is like those scenes, but then also like the personal stuff, seeing like the way in which the film like torments him, I think is so fascinating. But I mean, like, it's so talked about religiously, but it is the scene where the divorce is happening and you switch it to his POV and it's shaky film cam. And then he looks in the mirror and he sees himself. Like, that stuff is just so powerful. And we talked about it a little bit during our the Queer Quadrant qualifiers.
Yes.
But like, to see sort of how someone like your brain operates on screen is like a very overwhelming feeling.
This movie was
so that's what
you.
It was like. Yeah. And also, I was a queer little fucking film boy. So
I remember there was a time when my wife and I were having a very heavy conversation. It wasn't like we were gonna like split up or anything, but like, it was very much like we were sort of talking about our future. Were we going to have kids? You know, all these things. In the back of my brain, I was thinking about if I was ever, you know, going to like admit to myself that I was trans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I just remember like suddenly picturing filming it from above, like having, you know, a camera on a fucking, or, you know,
like a crane,
us standing against the wall so that it's like we can flip it if we're making a super low budget movie. And I just like, I remember thinking that way and then being like, a brain should not be doing this at this moment. And yet mine is, so good for me. Yeah. And like, obviously, you know, I'm a writer first and foremost, so I always am thinking in those terms, but I certainly, I've written a novel, which is out for sale right now and purchased. But like, I, now that I've written this novel, I like have so many times when I'm like, oh my God, you know, I'm thinking of the world in terms of like how I would describe it in the novel. And it's not always the most helpful emotional reaction. And like this movie captured that for me.
Yeah. I think it happens often in like the worst situations that you don't want it to happen. But it's just, that's sort of the power of movie making and also like this compartmentalizing of trauma and the way in which like you are able to deal with what is happening in the present day. And I think that's like the way that art impacts our lives is like, the whole point of art is like for us to express ourselves. And if you are like working within like a writing or a visual medium, so much of what you are taking in is then you are expounding upon onto a page or the screen. And so like, if that's how your brain works, this is a movie that is like all about showing you like the positives of that, where you're able to like express yourself in a good way, make people feel these positive emotional things. I mean, like when he makes his mom the video, again, such a relatable thing, because like the minute you are the filmmaker in a family, people are like, oh, can you make this like birthday thing for someone, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, there is like the weight in which it can hold you down, like discovering like certain things about your parents, or just the, you know, the way in which when he shoots his Nazi bully, and the way in which like that affects the bully and not recognizing the power of cinema and like the way in which you frame people has an impact on how people see themselves and each other. It's I'm just sure art that, is powerful, man.
I'm sure that a lot of our discussion of the movie's queerness will center on that hallway scene.
Of course,
like, that is such a fucking good scene about like 17 different things.
Yeah.
And one of them is like these two boys like edging up to admitting they're attracted to each other and then just never saying it, never actually realizing it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, so, and then it's about 16 other things.
Yeah.
Which is like, which is the, I'm a huge Tony Kushner stan. I was sad. I was up for a WGA award this year for an article.
Yeah.
And I was sad I couldn't go to the awards in New York because Kushner was like, there was like a special something tribute to him. And I was like, if I win, I can like thank him in my speech because I spent so much of high school shamelessly ripping him off. Yeah. And I'm sure he felt that in like the back of his brain. He feels it every time a 16-year-old queer kid is like, I'm going to write Angels in America.
Of course.
Then I lost, so it was good I wasn't there. You know, I lost to some other person. And you know what? It was a good article they wrote. But they stole my WGA award.
I was going to say.
Honestly, let's pull an Ocean's Heist to get that award.
Art is subjective, which means that in every world you should have won.
That's true.
That's the power of art. I think that, there's something disconcerting and uncomfortable about realizing that every emotional experience that you ever have can in some way, shape, or form make its way into something that is connected to you, but is then suddenly made public to other people, whether or not it's a one-to-one ratio.
For sure.
Like you're always, when you're at the most difficult part of writing a script or directing a scene where you just need to connect with the human emotion, what are you looking at? You're going back to the things that you have felt so deeply in your life.
And I mean, there's that scene in this movie during the World War II where one, Sammy Fableman is one of his most gay moments, but when he's directing the kid about like what emotion to feel, and it's coming off of the argument with his mom.
Yep.
And so he's exactly what you're saying, where he's like processing the trauma that his mom just inflicted upon him and how he's feeling, and then telling the kid that, and both like that's how directing works. It's like you're pulling from your real life and also trying to then get the actor to pull from their real life to then get the emotion that you're going for.
And it works. Makes the kid cry.
Exactly. And like the kid is broken.
It's crazy. I recently read Jeanette McCurdy's amazing book. Mm,
yes.
I'm glad my mom died. It's a wonderful book, but she, there's a chapter where she talks about how when she was a child actor, the most valuable thing you could do was cry on cue. That's what everyone wanted every child actor to be able to do. That's how you booked jobs. And how she would run at the age of like 10, would be running members of her family through like the most traumatizing aspects of, you know, loss and death and pain in her mind just to make herself cry on camera. Because that's what you had to do. And she realized this is something that she wanted. And the only way to really tap into those emotions was just traumatize herself over and over. And I think that obviously as we get older, we get better at compartmentalizing. But there's an element of filmmaking that I think The Fabelmans, you know, hits on so perfectly. That's like, this sucks. It's always going to suck. There's always going to be an element of it that really like breaks you apart. Yeah. But that's partially why we do it. It's punishing to be a filmmaker. And I think that, I don't know, The Fabelmans obviously works so well juxtaposing that with like his family and this idea of like guilt and punishment and feeling lesser than.
Art, family, it'll rip you in two.
Exactly. It's incredible to look at like what a raw movie this is, even though it has that like shiny Spielberg glow to it. When I rewatched the trailer this morning and the trailer just hits so differently after seeing the movie, because you're like, this really does kind of look like a schlocky,
Spielberg
basic
schmaltz.
Movie.
I genuinely think, I genuinely think the reason this movie didn't win a bunch of Oscars is that trailer and the poster. Those two things created a perception in people's minds of what this movie was that they just never escaped. They went in and they were like, well, it's Spielberg talking about how he loves the movies. And like, that's in there, but it is by no means like Belfast. It's kind of a weird movie. Like I don't like that movie, but it's weirder than you'd expect given like the log line on it. And that is that movie though. That is a movie about we're going to use the movies to escape whatever. And like it has political overtones, which is why I think it did slightly better at the Oscars. But like, yeah, this is not you know, just a fucking Empire of Light or something.
Right.
This is not a movie about a guy realizing how the movies can take you out of your real life. This is a guy realizing how the movies can like complicate and make your real life incredibly fucked up. And then you can't like process any emotions at all ever until you make a movie in your 70s that is you processing them with your good friend Tony Kushner, who's like, you sure about that, Stevie? You sure you're 100% like, straight?
Yes.
A $40 million therapy session, as Spielberg said.
And it's fine because people give Spielberg so much shit for all of his movies being about this incredible, like, moment in his life of his parents getting divorced. And when are you going to actually confront it head on? When are you going to give yourself that $40 million therapy session where it's like, you don't understand, I've been doing that for my entire career. And like, do I feel differently about it now? You don't know.
Right.
Like, this is a personal movie, but it's a very difficult movie. There's, you know, stories about being on set and how it was like very emotional and Spielberg would tear up a lot because he felt like he was directly recreating his childhood in so many ways.
Totally. Like rebuilt like his homes for off like blueprints and stuff like that. And
is that therapeutic or is that like
reliving trauma?
Self-flagellation
in
a way. It's, I mean, the truth is that it's probably a good deal of both.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I do think that there is a quality to this movie that is, it's a memory play, I guess, but like a really, like the thing about it is it has a very stage-like structure, which you'd expect given Kushner's involvement. And it is basically a three-act play. And by that, I don't mean the traditional three-act structure. I mean, it has basically three acts with a different lead of each act more or less, and then they coalesce at the end into a full thing. Like the first, basically this is 2.5 hours, basically like the first 30 minutes is kind of about Paul Dano, then the middle hour is kind of about Mitzi, played by Michelle Williams. And then the last hour is about, you know, Sammy, played by Gabriel LaBelle. So, like, it switches lead characters. Mm-hmm. It does a lot of, like, complicated things. It has a very stage-like structure. And, like, I think a lot of that is just stuff that, you know, the trailer and the poster just kind of flattened into the magic of the movies. And yeah. Isn't it wonderful? And I think they thought that was kind of their play for audiences. And I think they thought that was their play for awards, especially, sort of neglecting that, like, I think the way you win the Oscar now has changed.
Yeah.
If you are a movie, and I think, like, a lot of people haven't grappled with that. A lot of Oscar bloggers are grappling with that and having, like, just total meltdowns at the fact yes. that, like, they can no longer just, like, look for the most Oscar-y movie and predict that.
Right, right.
But, you know, if you're a Green Book or a Coda and you win, those are traditional Oscar movies. You win because you kind of come out of nowhere and people right. are surprised by you and excited by you. And outside of that, people want to be, I think all the time about in 2017 when Dunkirk was a huge hit, a war movie, Christopher Nolan, a filmmaker that obviously is going to win a Best Director Oscar at some point. Like, it just felt like that could be his coronation moment. And then it kind of went nowhere. Like, I feel like the Academy Award voters, but also film goers more generally, want to be totally surprised and want to have this thing that feels unexpected and new and kind of weird and kind of out there. And I think that the approach they took to sell The Fabelmans was an approach that would have won them Best Picture in, you know, 2002.
Yeah.
And it just could not in 2022. Oh, God, 2002 was 20 years ago. What mm-hmm. have I done with my life?
I know.
But it really, like, I think it really solidified in the public's mind a vision of this movie that it was not. And I think it did not help that it came out on the heels of Belfast, which is yeah. that movie that the public yeah. thought it was. And it didn't help that it came out the same season as Empire of Light and Babylon. Babylon, of course, I love, but also is very much a movie about, isn't it wonderful to make movies?
Right.
But also, it's a terrible curse.
Even like Armageddon Time, like similarly.
Yeah, Armageddon Time is like less about the movies, but certainly but like plays in that similar thing of, I am a director examining my childhood, though obviously James Gray is less of a household name than even Kenneth Branagh.
Right.
But like, yeah, it is. I don't know. I think there's just a thing that they should have sold this movie as like a psychological thriller. Genuinely.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
should have sold. Like my well, I mean, idea.
It is. Like,
it's hard. Yeah. It's hard to make a poster for this movie. But like, I think the poster is like the poster I would pitch is it's like the family taking a portrait and Sammy's in there, but he's also like taking the picture.
Yeah.
So like there's two of him. And so then people would come in and think it was like a fucking doppelganger movie, but that's fine. Sometimes you just got to trick people into seeing small, personal, beautiful movies.
Yes. I do think pitching this as kind of dark Spielberg. Spielberg is finally making the movie about his life. Why has it taken him so long? You're about to find out. Instead of being like, this is the culmination of everything, would have been interesting to see that marketing campaign. I think that like nothing exemplifies what I dislike about how this movie was marketed more than the fact that in the poster, the horizon is in the middle.
Mm.
It's boring as shit.
Yeah.
Like it's, and technically, yes, that's a still frame from the movie, but it removes the context of that being a still frame and says like, oh, great, here you go. It's for the poster. And it's like, no, that's actually the antithesis of like what the movie is.
Right.
Here's an alternate poster pitch. You remember how there was a baby in the sun in Teletubbies?
Yes.
So it's just like a scene from the movie, but there's a sun up there and Steven Spielberg's face is in it and he's just like smiling down upon everyone.
I like that. I think that's good.
I need the Photoshop. I will immediately. Do that. Okay.
His little, the Spielberg smile.
I guess he has such a good smile.
He really does. No, I completely agree. I think like, but also like that ending. So like, it's probably like the best ending shot maybe ever and says so many different things, not only just about like the movie, but about like Sammy. And like, there's a darkness to the over like gleeful music and the like flinging of his arm skip that he has. Like, there's just so much to read into. Even that shot itself, like, it's just such a fucking textured movie. But what you were saying earlier about the like darkness, etc. I think what's so fascinating is like Sammy is at first introduced to the movies and he's terrified. And like the whole point of like him grappling is like he's trying to control his trauma of the train incident and the power of movies from like childhood. And I think that's such an interesting way to like start looking at his career in the movies. It's like he starts out not by being so overwhelmed and in love with the movies, but by being traumatized and scared. And like, how can I recreate this thing to gain control and therefore be able to process my trauma? And that is his filmmaking since he was born. Like, that's just what he's been constantly doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like it is sort of badly understood how much every person on this planet has traumatizing stuff in their lives. And like the degree to which, you know, we can say, oh, I have trauma is complicated. I think I think everybody has trauma. So then that word has gotten a little bit like ironed out, like there's less of power to it. So then you're like, well, I have PTSD, you know, have you gotten diagnosed for that? But like everybody has a traumatizing thing in their past. And the process of human life is figuring out how to funnel that into something mm-hmm. that doesn't utterly destroy you. And for most of us, it's like, oh, you know what? I was 4. Because when you're a kid, you don't understand the world. So I was 4 and I got lost in a department store, or, you know, I was in a car accident. Something kind of totally normal, but that your 4-year-old brain interpreted as the right. end of the world. And it's hard to unlearn that. Even if the rest of your life was 100% stable, you're constantly sort of, some part of you is constantly stuck in that moment. And the way, like humanity is like figuring out a way to move past that. And like, one of the things I'm going to hopefully do throughout this is I read this movie as much more broadly queer beyond just Sammy Fableman, obviously being super into boys.
The queer
and
icon
then, of course,
here.
You know, when he made his late in life masterpiece, The Spielbergs, which
I
was
heard
about
how,
that.
Yeah.
Which is about how he was also attracted to women. People
right.
were like, whoa, this is fucking brilliant. He's coming out as bisexual this late in life.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, too, because, you know, in that movie, it starts out with him having, you know, there's a love interest in that movie. And he actually did have a girlfriend in high school, but he was saying for so long that he didn't have a girlfriend in high school. Sort of the inverse of this movie. It's so wild how that plays out.
It's but I read this as more broadly queer because I have kind of a broad definition of queerness. But we'll talk about that soon, I'm sure. But it is just like, I think one of the things that is true about being queer, particularly in the United States, is there is a dissociative quality to it. There is a part of you that kind of has to pull back from our aggressively, especially like when the three of us were growing up, our aggressively cishet culture, and like just sort of observe it from afar and be like, that seems weird. Why are they making so many John Wick movies? I enjoy them, but I don't understand.
Yeah.
There is that quality to it. And I feel like one of the reasons a lot of queer people become artists is because you can process dissociation through art so effectively.
Yes.
And yet Steven Spielberg has had no therapy and keeps talking about his parents' divorce. And I have had tons of therapy, and yet everything I write is just about like being a survivor of abuse. It's like, that's all I can talk about because right. your brain gets stuck there and that's where the art lives. And it just keeps vomiting itself up on the page or on the screen or, you know, on a canvas if you're a painter, which seems like a weird way to make a living, but you do you, you know.
Shout out to the
so
painters
much
out there.
Weirder than
go
being a
painters.
Filmmaker.
Right, we have to stand.
Go find artists. No. And I also think that like there is a distinctly different style between the straightforwardness of therapy and the artistry of something like filmmaking or fine arts. Like most screenplays that I write have some thread about how pissed off I am about having to be a woman in society. Even if
what?
Like I and it's like I don't necessarily want to complain through my screenwriting, but then it's also like I do.
But why not?
Because it feels more therapeutic to me to put things in that artistic framework than necessarily like sit I was going to say to my therapist's office, but on Zoom with my therapist, and be like, this is fucking annoying. Mm-hmm. And I think there is an element of invention to fine arts that is just like extra therapeutic, because you can either go the escapist route and being like, well, you know, I can make my character do whatever they want, and in a way I can like fix myself. I can say that like maybe I had to go through this, but my character doesn't. Mm. And that makes me feel better. Or you can do the inverse and be like, let's figure out how I would feel about this very upsetting thing happening right to my character.
Can we do a fun screenwriting as a woman sidebar in we this should. Podcast? Why not? Yes. Let's do it right now. I am so fucking frustrated by it. I transitioned later in life. Before that, I had been, you know, screenwriting. I'm putting air quotes around this for all the listeners at home. As a man, and like I just exclusively wrote woman protagonists, and I got so much attention for that. People were like, "You write women so well. That is amazing." And my scripts were 10 times worse because I was a dissociative husk who wasn't writing anything useful. The first script I wrote that was any good was about a teenage girl. And I was like, I'm really finding it easy to relate to this teenage girl. Let's pull on that thread a little bit. Anyway, here I am. My name's Emily St. James. And I'm on the podcast Queer Quadrant talking about queerness.
Yes, you are.
And now it's like, obviously, right, things have changed a little bit. It is, I think, harder to sell projects at this moment in time than it's been the whole time I've been trying to do this. But we have had that script about a teenage girl developed a handful of times. And every time you reach a point where somebody says, well, who's going to watch this? Who's going to watch this thing about teenage queer girls in the middle of nowhere? And it's like, I mean, probably somebody... If not a lot of people watch it, I guess you'll just have to cancel it, and that'll be sad, but whatever. But like, I don't know. I feel like there is this increasingly we had this time when the studios and networks were open to perspectives other than that of the straight white guy. And somehow, increasingly, it's become even more narrow. It's become like, we are interested in a straight white man in his 50s. And you're like, what? Like,
yeah. It's like the establishment of like someone who is like, quote unquote, established, or like has the ability to like be a showrunner or transfer this IP. But then you look at some of the people that they bring on, and they aren't people who do that. And when they are people that they bring on who don't have that backstory, they're usually just men also.
Yeah.
They're
usually just established white guys. I had a very illuminating conversation with a writer who's been like staffing regularly for years, and she's a woman of color. And she was like, 90% of the time, what happens is it's not my story that gets bought. It's a studio looking at their slate and being like, oh, fuck, these are all stories about white guys. Let's change that one into a woman of color. Oh, fuck, we don't have any women of color. Let's go find someone to come in and like do this for us. And she was like, sometimes it's really wonderful and you make the project your own, but more often than not, and she was like, my reps have been good about protecting me from this, you get people that want you to come in to do the sensitivity pass.
Yeah.
Because they forgot that diversity is important now, and that people want to see their own stories on screen. And so then sort of last minute they scrambled and realized that, well, let's just change the perspective and bring someone in to make sure that we can wash our hands of it. And then we'll all move on with our lives. Which is incredibly frustrating.
I feel like it's also like the point. It's like where you're, it's like that where they either like forget, or it's like where people want to like similarly like have a checkbox of something, whether it be like diversity, queerness in whatever shape or form. And without like thinking about like the context of it or who should be telling it or whatnot, it's just to have the X thing on the slate without actually like contemplating about the way in which the plot or themes or machinations actually like affect audiences. And so it's like, oh, we have our queer story. Should we have a queer person tell it? I don't know. Oh, we have a trans narrative. Do we need a trans person on it? I don't know. How are the politics? It's a trans story. It's fine. It's a gay story. It's fine. It's like, no,
you're
like,
not
think about it.
They don't think about it unless it is, again, a chance for them to wash their hands and be like, we can claim that we're not responsible for this because we put the people that always yell at us in this box and like just kind of let them deal with it.
I will say, when when I was, again, when I was living as a person who wasn't me, and we were trying to sell this show about the teenage girl, it was like not, it wasn't going to happen. I want to be clear that like we didn't ever get close to the point where it was going to happen. But every time there would be the conversation, because I wrote it with my wife, every time there would be the conversation about, well, do you want a show run? And we'd be like, I guess. And they'd be like, okay. And now, like, so now it's way easier for us to break in because I'm trans and people want trans voices. But the idea of like advancing through the ranks has suddenly become a lot harder. Whereas before, people were like, why don't you just come in at the top and we'll see what happens? And like, I don't know. I think I wrote this novel as a lark. And like, I have been every step of the way, it's just been easier to like, A, to try and sell it, B, to like find representation, C, all these things. And like, some of that is because there's lower overhead on a novel. You just print it on paper. I don't know if you've heard about like how novels work.
It's interesting. But this is a new development. Does Sammy Fableman know about novels?
But it's, yeah, it is. People give you notes, and if you don't take them and are like, I just don't think that doesn't fit my vision, they're like, okay, sounds great. Good, they good, good. Really, and it's just like, but my passion is still like, I want to fucking make these stories on screen. And yet the gatekeepers have just locked the gates down even more. Unless you can find a project that is, you know, IP driven. We've had, and even then we've had some nibbles over the years at Arden, which is, you know, the fiction podcast that I co-created, where people are like, maybe we turn this into a TV show. And I'm like, it would just be a show about two people solving crimes, but okay. But, you know, then they find out it's about lesbians and they stop emailing us. So
it's really fascinating. It's so difficult. And I think that something that I quite like about The Fablemans is that it is about, in some ways, the magic of the movies before you have to contend with the business
politics of
movies and what you're walking into. But at the same time, and again, I don't think that this is like a negative of the movie, but the final 5 minutes with the John Ford conversation and then Sammy walking off, skipping because he's so happy that he understands this new element about like what makes art work on this great epic scale is like, you have no idea what you're walking into. Mm-hmm. Like, you have no idea the bloodbath that you're about to embark on by moving through the studio backlot.
Yeah.
But also, it's a movie about Steven Spielberg.
But it's also, I think that's what's so interesting. And I think it's where the Judd Hirsch thing kind of comes back in, like, the way in which he talks about, like, how art will tear you apart. And it's like, you know that, like, the family-wise, but, like, it's, you then think about it retroactively and, like, whether you put it onto Spielberg's life or just people who work within film and the way in which, like, the hours and what it actually takes to make movies, both, like, on the, like, commercial business side of things, the family, like, being away for so long and, like, the like, stakes that, like, holds onto your heart. It's just, it's tremendous. Yeah. And I completely agree with you.
I think what's so important about that last sequence is the like literal like last 2 seconds of the whole movie when the camera adjusts so that suddenly the horizon's in the right place. It is very much saying Sammy thinks he understands things. He has no fucking clue. No. Steven Spielberg is probably just the most natural person to have ever picked up a camera and understand how to use it and where to place it and all of that. He's saying, I'm still figuring this out. I'm still learning. And like,
and he didn't,
I think it is very heartening. I think it's very heartening to see this kid who is, you know, very similar to Steven Spielberg, though he is, of course, a famous filmmaker in his own right.
We have to make sure we say that difference.
But like figuring out, you know, like writing letters to try and get a job on Hogan's Heroes and like learning, having this lesson from John Ford, like seeing him learning and realizing that, you know, he's analogous, though not the same as Steven Spielberg, and being like, okay, yeah, the finest to have ever done it, like had to learn all of this as well.
What's so fascinating even on that is like Spielberg on the DGA podcast was talking about that last shot and his operator couldn't get it. It was looking too good. Spielberg then was like, cool, let me do it. He did it. It was still too professional looking. So he had to then in post go and have them be like, can you make this look really worse?
Jankier.
So it's like he is so talented even on set trying to make it look bad that he can't make it look bad. Like he is just that unbelievable, which is fucked up.
Good problems. Champagne problems.
Truly.
By Taylor Swift.
There is on that, the like, thing you wanted to say though, like when he, the final scene with him and Paul Dano is so fucking gutting, like the panic attacks, you know, who can relate, of course. But when he talks about like his life going by so fast and isn't going anywhere is like maybe one of the most relatable and gutting things of all time, especially within the context of like working within the film industry. So since you were just talking about how dour and brutal those final 10 minutes were, I feel like we just had to touch on that.
I think that that also ties in very nicely, Emily, to what you were saying about this being a broadly queer movie, is that there is a certain element of like, I don't know how much time I have. I don't have the same perception of time that maybe other people do. And I also feel that line so incredibly hard. My life is going by so fast and what have I done? And the idea that you can still feel like that, like we get lovable flack all the time for how young we are, even though there are people who are years younger than us that are years ahead of us.
So true.
And that's just fucking life. I'm 19. Deal with it.
That's,
I'm 19.
Yeah. And so, is Sammy Fableman. So
forever. Yeah. But I really do think there's this sense of like, I have to grasp onto this because if I don't, I don't know how much time I have. Yeah. I don't know it. Your life just doesn't quite feel stable in the same way that you imagine other people's lives do. I really loved Spielberg when he was talking about why he wanted to make this movie now, and he like sort of famously made it very soon after his parents died and made it in the middle of the pandemic, being like, oh God, like I suddenly am very aware of my own mortality, and I haven't made the one movie that I really need to make that I have been making in bits and pieces over and over and over again for my whole career. But that he specifically wanted to make this movie about the time when you as a child stop seeing your parents as your parents and start seeing them as individual people. And to me, that is one of like the most kind of like, I guess uncanny valley is not quite the right word, but one of the most, again, just sort of like discombobulating, weird, unnerving parts of growing up.
Yes.
Is realizing that like
your parents are people.
The stability that you thought was available to other people besides you is maybe not available to anybody. But you still feel like you're all alone and that your life is going by too fast and that other people haven't figured it out.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the people that are closest to you, who are the ones that are supposed to have figured it out and give you advice about how to get through this thing that you're feeling really awful about, also don't know what they're doing.
Especially if it happens at a younger age too, like he, like if it's, you know, like when you're graduated or whatever.
I started going to therapy.
Oh my, Mitzi Fableman, is that you? But like, especially if it happens when you're such a kid and like you have to like start either A, taking care of your parents, or your parents start leaning on you for things, or you're hearing these arguments, et cetera, et cetera. It's like to process that when you're so young is so difficult because like on one hand, you just don't know what to do because you yourself are a child. And so then like, what do you do with this trauma? And you do what Spielberg does, and is you bottle it and you make it into a little movie, and then you shove your mom in the closet to see it.
Isn't it? Well, I also love that he makes all his movies in the closet. Like, let's
come on, Steven.
I know that you are other reasons, but
you know, he told that to Tony, and Tony was like, that's really interesting. Let's talk about it. And Steven's like, yep, I made him and I put him in a closet, and that's where I screened him. You're like,
so good.
And that's where I hid all my little insecurities. And
it was,
that's
a
where
terrible
I went.
Steven Spielberg impression. I apologize.
I didn't even do like a good Steven.
No,
Steven's
it's
a hard
impossible.
One.
He's just, and he's so sweet that I never want to, I never wish Steven Spielberg any ill will.
Oh my God.
You know,
no.
I know he's a complicated person. I'm sure he has his pros and his cons, but I really have like so much affection for him. Yeah.
When Jimmy Kimmel was making jokes about him at the Oscars, and they were pretty mild jokes, all things considered, I was like, oh, just leave him alone.
That's okay. I'm like, come on, let him live. Let Dad live. He's fine. He doesn't need this. I did see him. My screening was at like a, I was gifted a WGA ticket.
Oh, WGA ticket.
And so I was able to see him there, and it was like one of those experiences when you see someone that you like look up to your whole life, and you see them then in person, and you like don't know what to do. You know what I mean?
In like, many ways, you were like Emily St. James front row at the Taylor Swift
concert. That's true. Yeah, Steven Spielberg did look at me, and he was like, "I'm bi now," and I was like, "Oh my God, my power!" So,
good for you. Good for you.
Yeah. Good for Congratulations, you. Everyone. I outed Steven Spielberg.
No, I'm sorry. I interrupted your very nice point.
It was just, it's just so overwhelming to like see someone that you like admire and look up to, even if you like don't interact, but like when you're within the confines of like 10 feet or so, you know what I mean? But and on the dad thing, he's so short and just so full of life and joy.
And his
like,
nice little smile.
Exactly. You know? He's just like, he's so happy with this movie. And he's like, I was able to go to therapy as well by making this movie.
Good for
him. He seems like such a nice grandpa.
Yeah.
He just has nice grandpa energy. He seems like he has a little like fanny pack and he opens it up and he has like a little Ziploc bag of M&Ms in there. And he opens up. I was like, do you want some M&Ms? And you're like, yes, I do, Grandpa.
I would love
Steve.
Some. You know, I was watching this movie and I was really wondering what Sammy Fabelman was wearing. And I started doing some online research. Were you able to find the same thing?
Yeah, you know what's shocking is that his favorite online brand of all time is Super Yaki.
Oh my God.
This is a fact. That's definitely not something that made up.
But yeah, I discovered
real
that.
Life man, Sammy Fabelman is a Super Yaki stan.
I would say he's like the spokesperson for Super Yaki.
When he won his Oscar, he was actually wearing Super Yaki merch head to toe. Yeah, it was unprecedented.
No, it was really
really brave of him.
It was.
But, you know, I think it's worth it because Super Yaki is the best shop on the internet terms of high-quality cinema-loving materials, whether you're in the market for T-shirts, sweatshirts, hats, socks, everything from the appreciation of Keanu Reeves to the appreciation of the Scream franchise. I mean, anything you could possibly want celebrating the movies and the filmmakers that we love, it's available for you.
Oh my God.
And you know, Super Yaki is now based right here in Los Angeles.
That's
true. Don't worry if you're anywhere else, it's not Los Angeles because they ship ship with environmentally conscious materials. So you can feel good about what you're buying and who you're buying it from.
Oh my God.
And you know, us and Sammy Fabelman have teamed up for something really special for
y'all.
That's
true. Yeah, we have.
We were cooking. We have a code for our friends, our followers, our fellow cinephiles. Mm-hmm. If you would like 10% off your order, enter SuperQQ at checkout.
What?
Code SuperQQ, all caps, no spaces.
It's like puncturing film.
Yeah,
10%
honestly.
Off.
And it's really innovative. Mm-hmm. And it's a visionary thing to do.
Yeah,
in
we're
the same
pushing
way
the form.
That Sammy is a visionary filmmaker. So if the spirit moves you, the spirit of cinema, the spirit of Sammy Fabelman, and honestly, it really is a wonderful way to show that you love
the movies.
You can find everything that you could possibly want at superyaki.com. That's SuperYaki.com. Jordan, movies are magic.
Movies are dreams.
Something that we haven't touched on yet that I would love to is the other thing that Steven Spielberg gets some flack for is his aversion to sexuality, by which I mean sexual content and not necessarily like queerness in his oeuvre. And that this film kind of looks at that head on in a bunch of different ways.
It's
like,
incredible.
It's not like there's one scene that's like, and this is why Spielberg is kind of iffy on sex in his films.
Right.
There's a lot of different elements where you're like, oh, mm-hmm. I see how that makes sense.
Yes.
Of course, my favorite character in the film, besides
shout her out,
Sammy Fabelman, is Chloe East, who plays
his
Catholic high school girlfriend, Monica Sherwood, one of the most like waspy names.
Have you let Jesus into you? Also, a little gay.
Yeah.
She was on some TV show, Chloe East, like a few years ago that I watched for TCA. The show wasn't very good, but I was like, who's this kid? She seems fun. And then she turns up in this, and I was like, yes, right again. I did it.
You're like Steven Spielberg casting a kid.
She is.
You know, you have the eye. Yeah.
She's so excellent. She is apparently in Generation, that HBO Max show that was very short-lived, which is, it's interesting to think of her as kind of like a young actor, because something that I think is special about all the kids in this movie, Gabriel LaBelle and Julia Butters and Chloe East, is that Oaks Fegley, how could I forget? They all kind of seem like out of time a little bit. They seem like kids of this era. So it's weird to think of the fact that Chloe East was on a show that's about like Gen Zers.
No, 100%.
Because I was like, no, I don't understand. She was spawned as a Catholic schoolgirl in the 1950s, 60s. What the fuck does this movie take 60s. Place?
1964, they graduate.
I love her in this. I think this to me, you know how you're like, Jordan, you're like, this movie was made for me. I am Sammy. Sammy is me. I mean, one of my first thoughts when I watched this movie is I was like, oh my God, this is a movie about Jordan, but in the best
literally
way.
Like even the bully, like yeah. to the bullying sequel, like it's fucked up. I'm like, this is not okay. I feel added by Steven Spielberg.
Surprised he didn't get a bloody nose randomly once or twice.
Honestly true.
But when the scene of Chloe East bringing
yes.
Sammy to her bedroom, and it's like she kind of has a weird fetish for Jesus, but in the fact that it's like when you're, and I was like, it's incredible that Steven Spielberg managed to capture this very specific like Catholic thing in a movie that is all about being Jewish. When you are a girl who's hitting puberty and you are Christian and or Catholic, you learn that you have to suppress every single sexual feeling that you have ever had, but it's okay if it's for Jesus.
I have no chill when people don't like this movie. I also have no chill when they don't like Avatar The Way of Water, but that's a separate discussion. Actually, no, when people don't like Avatar The Way of Water, I'm like, you probably have a good reason, but also there's a depressed whale. Come on.
Come on.
But I have no chill when people don't like this movie. And like one of the people I saw criticizing it was like, I think it was an Oscar blogger. They were very much like, oh, come on. No girl would have a crush on Jesus. And I was like, every girl.
No idea.
Every girl, even the gay girls, kind of. Because like there's an androgynous quality to white Jesus. There's a very like he's very pretty and handsome at the same time. Yeah. It's like, yeah, I don't know. I also like Scott a lot of like, there's never been a person like Mitzi Fabelman or whatever, Bert
yeah,
Fabelman.
Bert.
There's never been people like them. And I'm like, I've met so many people like them. Like,
yeah.
I feel like, I don't know. I feel like people are attack this movie on the grounds of being unrealistic, probably because of the fact that it is based on the life of the real Sammy Fabelman.
Right.
And like, but it is very much, you know, it is, there are people like this. I think you just, What I'm trying to say is girls want to bang Jesus.
Girls
want to
bang Jesus. And we all saw Benedetta, a masterpiece.
True. When she's like, he's sexy. And Sammy, slip up there. My God. Sammy is like, yeah, he kind of is. Like he kind of acknowledges that Jesus is a little hot, which is another little gay moment there.
Mm-hmm. There's been some good memes about the way that Gabriel Labelle chooses to stand as Sammy Fabelman with this little hands on hips, like pop
chest out
situation. I just think it's really funny.
It's so good.
Again, the memes that came from this movie seemed like incredible. They were really tailored to like this conversation that we're having right now.
I'm fascinated by how the movie seems to have taken off a little bit at home. Like it was a flop in theaters, which probably killed its awards hopes. But at home, it's been like it's become a big deal. Like it's led the VOD charts every so often. It's been it's been a minor hit. And you can see that as these memes sort of propagate, or even just people pulling short sections out and putting them on Twitter, sometimes to say they're not good, but usually to say they're good.
Yeah.
For a while, there was this thing going around of the shot when Seth Rogen is revealed as they're moving to Arizona. And it's just, even in a vacuum, it's so fucking funny. I don't know.
So funny.
Chill when people don't like this movie. Go ahead.
The shot, like even the shot with Seth Rogen, just being a Seth Rogen, great performance. But when Sammy screens his World War II movie and Steven Spielberg literally cucks his own dad by like panning over from Michelle to Seth Rogen to show Seth and not Bert is so gutting.
It's a very funny movie.
It's so funny.
He does feel like he can laugh at his own pain. This is, like I said, I think I said earlier, this movie does feel a little bit like self-flagellation.
Yes.
But it does feel like therapy. I would agree with Jordan that the most gutting scene is him disassociating during the divorce. But the scene that has definitely like stuck with me the most is the hallway scene, which we've sort of been talking around.
Ugh.
And
Jesus, it's the best scene. Fablemans is not my number one of 2022, but that is my favorite scene by far.
Should we build up to it from like the beach?
The beach.
Because I feel like it starts with the beach, which is also an incredible montage of like the making of movies. It has that shot where Chloe East comes up behind him and like nudges his face to like see into the camera.
See through the viewfinder.
And it is like the most romantic thing I think I've ever seen on screen.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful.
Yeah, hey, listen, if a girl did that to me, I can imagine proposing to her at high school prom.
I would drop on a knee immediately.
Listen, if I had been dating Monica Sherwood in high school, I would have proposed to her at prom. She just seems great.
At prom. And she, the thing is, it's such a nice breakup. She's like, I'm not going to do that, Sam. That's I can't do that.
Another relatable thing, being dumped your senior year right before you go away.
Yeah. I do think it's very healthy to break up with your high school significant other, though. Never go to college with a high school.
Yeah, it does not last. We'll say that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I met my wife the first day of college.
Oh!
Whoa.
Maybe a bad idea to get married that young, but I mean, we have a baby now.
I was gonna say, that's true. You got a baby. I the beach scene.
So basically, like, he films the isn't Chad or not Chad? No, it's Logan. Sorry, Logan.
His name is not Chad. Can you imagine?
The main bully, played by Oakes Fegley of Pete's Dragon fame, is named Chad.
He's so let's clear. There's two bullies.
There's Logan, the main one.
Sam Reckner, who is Logan, the hot bully. And then we have Oakes so Fegley as Chad, the less hot and much more
anti-Semitic
bully. Logan is kind of just like your hot quarterback,
yes,
mean guy.
Classic jock, yeah.
They kind of have a good cop, bad cop bullying routine.
Yes, they do.
Even though they're like both bullies, it's very much like Logan's the guy who's like, hey, listen, I'm your friend here. I'm going to just push you into the locker for your own good, because if I don't, this guy here is going to make it much worse.
Yeah. Right. And Chad is like actually evil.
Chad's like a sociopath.
Truly a sociopath. Yeah. I was shocked.
It's a little upsetting.
Yeah. But at this point, Sam is 16 and word has gotten out that he's a filmmaker. So his high school asks him to shoot the senior day, which again, deeply relatable, I'm sure.
Incredible, of course. Yeah. Yes.
I want to say about the anti-Semitism in this film that obviously it's been a lot of discussion. I'm impressed by how uncreative it is. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Like, the kids are just choosing the most basic slurs, the most basic things to get mad at a Jewish person about. And it's like, that is how kids are.
Yes.
And like, the first time I saw it, I was like, well, that's a little over obvious. And then I thought about it for 5 seconds and I was like,
what do people
make fun of you for being obviously queer in high school? You know, they called you all the obvious slurs and then implied you were having sex with your best friend.
Yeah.
And I wasn't, because my best friend was a girl and they wouldn't have understood what to do with that, but it would have been gay. So.
Right. No, 100%. Yeah, they're like bagel men. Oh, that's so good, bro. Nice insult. And you're like, oh, God, get better.
Yeah, but that's why, I don't know, kids bullying is just very different than the sort of insidious prejudice that you experience as an adult, because it is deeply uncreative and it's a base the kids don't really understand. It's this whole idea. It sounds very like schmaltzy when you say it, but like hate has to be taught. It really does. And when you're 15, 16, 17, you don't really understand why. You just understand this is the thing to do.
Yeah.
So of course it's uncreative because there's a certain level of regurgitation and repetition.
I'm only teaching my child to hate AI. Like, so
that's smart.
My kid's going to be so fucking anti-robot someday, and
hell,
it's going to be a problem.
ChatGPT found dead in a ditch.
Yeah. So we film Ditch Day, and Sammy Fableman, then we showed for the whole school, and instead of staying throughout the whole movie, leaves, goes to the hallway, and starts contemplating life and crying.
I also feel like very filmmaker move to be like, I can't watch other people watch this movie.
Yes, let me out of this room.
The pressure is too much.
The conclusion of the screening, which is a oneer that travels, Spielberg famous for his oneers, that travels through this gym just and checks in on all these characters in perfectly framed shots and ends on Monica going over the camera to find Sam. And that little moment of like, well, maybe she would have proposed to him at that moment, because like his powers were so evident. And like, that's so beautiful too. But he's just not there, because he can't be there. He's never present when the thing is happening. He's somewhere else, this time literally, but usually, you know, in his brain.
Yeah. Imagine being able to go back and reshoot your high school movies, like literally recreate them, but make them better. Like, that is such a fucking flex. Like, I want to go back and reshoot my high school shit.
Yeah. That feels like it would really like heal some shit, heal some wounds deep inside you. I also think that, like, equal credit obviously to Kushner for writing this incredible scene, but being able to, like, write that hallway scene, it just feels so cathartic.
So Chad, not Chad, God, I always call him Logan. Chad. Logan comes up to
he
him.
He looks like a Chad.
He looks like a Chad. He is a Chad.
Logan,
like,
who is the good cop of good cop, bad cop, bully syndrome, and very, very good looking, very like golden boy. I think I saw some tweet that was like, oh, the Ditch Day video like has that sort of like cinematic appreciation of the male form. When we were in college, and we can debate the ethics of Emerson College teaching us this, we studied like Leni Riefenstahl's famous like diving video and talked about the cinematic appreciation of the male form, and how that's been like, you know, a thing in cinema, and how it's not necessarily a sexual thing. It's just kind of like, you just see what looks good. It's like Michelangelo's David, ignoring the fact that Michelangelo was a raging homosexual, but whatever.
It is this constant theme in art, in human history, which is like the male form as very beautiful. And also, you know, people will appreciate the female form, but the male form, and obviously I'm using a very gender essentialist take on this, but that is what these statues and paintings and everything are. My favorite review of this movie on Letterboxd is from, I believe, Peter Labuza, who's like, I did not expect Spielberg's chief cinematic influence on this to be Leni Riefenstahl's Olympia.
It really is.
I mean, it's, you get the sense that that is obviously something that must have crossed his mind.
For sure.
Because ultimate cinephile, Steven Spielberg, for better or for worse. But like, thinking about that specific juxtaposition is fucking crazy.
Like the whole Jewish angle
of
it too.
You turned your anti-Semitic bully into a little bit of like an
a
Aryan,
white god.
Nazi influence.
I love how that video also just shows how psychologically intuitive Sammy is. And like, he understands he can drive a wedge between these boys if he can just like make one of them look like a doof and one of them look like the greatest person to have ever lived. But he doesn't understand he's doing that.
Yeah.
Just subconsciously, he's aware he can do this and make it happen and drive that wedge and pull Logan a little closer and push Chad a little further away. And it's brilliant is what it is. It's great.
And like the like even like the characters, like the tertiary characters, like there's that one kid who gets like the bird shit, quote unquote, the ice cream in his mouth.
Is that Chad? Isn't that Chad?
No, it's it's like some other random. Some but like the high school kid. Like he nails the high school reaction of when you're filmed or when like a kid is filmed and like they screen it and he has like a funny bit and the overreaction to be like, look at me. Like even those micro fucking tiny moments he nails. And then when she turns off the music, like all of these things are just coalescing together so fucking well.
Underrated performance in this movie is the girl who plays Monica's friend and Logan's girlfriend. I don't remember the name of the actress offhand.
This is Isabel Kuzman. And she has been she's not the one that has had like the crazy career.
No, she is.
Far. She is.
Yes. She is the Licorice Pizza Fablemans to Megalopolis trifecta.
Yes. it's absolutely insane.
It's kind of fucked.
She has been in, she's only been in four movies. One of them was a short film and the other three were Licorice Pizza, Megalopolis, and the Fablemans.
That's so crazy.
Insane.
I love, one of my favorite moments in the prom scene is when she's singing Walk On By and it's very pretty and then the trumpet girls brap, 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 brap. It's great. It's perfect. It's funny.
Oh God. Wait, so then, so back to the hallway. you made me look like a golden god. Why did you make me look like that?
I've been an asshole. Right. How did you do this?
Right. I'm an asshole to her. I'm an asshole to you. Why the fuck are you doing this? Like, then when Sammy's like, do you feel bad? You should feel bad. And then the whole, like, I wanted you to be nice to me for 5 minutes, or maybe I want to make my movie better. I don't fucking know. I made you look like you could fly. And then the kid goes, I can't fly.
You made me feel like a phony. And Sammy's like, I don't know what to tell you. I just know that this is what the movie had to be.
Right.
And it pisses me off.
Yeah.
And it makes me feel very conflicted and maybe a little bit attracted to you, but also mad because you're not a nice person to me, but I had to make you look good because like the art is bigger than me.
Right.
The movie is bigger than what I want, and that's just what it had to be, but it pisses me off.
Yeah. Yeah. God. And then fucking Chad comes out, and I think that's what's so beautiful is when Chad like comes to fucking punch him and Logan stands up for him, and even though Sammy. It sucks we don't like Logan, I think it is hilarious that he beats the shit out of Chad and Chad goes scrambling, and so you have that crack of the neck classic like tough guy moment, and then you have like maybe the best line of the entire movie where he's like, don't tell anybody about this, and he's like, well, I won't, but what if I made a movie about it? Wink, wink.
I believe the line is, I won't unless I make a movie about it.
Right, and you're
which
like,
I never would.
Right. Steven Spielberg never would. Sammy Fableman would, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sammy Fableman. Well, and Steven Spielberg technically made it for Sammy.
That's
so it
true.
Is like there was a little loophole in there. Yeah.
You're
know?
Watching the damn movie that he made. I think that there's also just sort of like in line with it, Logan cracking his neck, being able to play the tough guy from defending Sammy. Like, if that's not so kind of like knight in shining armor in a fucked
right.
up way.
Yes.
I don't know what is.
100%.
Speaking of famous queer artists who had biopics made about them last year, do you think Sammy Fableman has ever met the very real Lydia Tarr?
Interesting. I bet so. Yeah, probably when she won her, because she's EGOTed. So yeah. when
they
won
chatted
her,
at the Oscars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I bet they were actually buddies on the award circuit.
Mm.
You know? Yeah. They would often be seated at the same table as people yeah. tend to seat venerated queer artists together.
It's kind of problematic, though, because Sammy Fableman hasn't said anything about Lydia Tarr since all the allegations came out.
Once again.
So it's a little rough.
There's reason
there's something
to cancel.
Really going on with Sammy Fableman. Yeah,
there's
we should talk about it.
I clicked over to my Slack with my wife to tell her that the baby, you know, needs someone to come and take the baby. And because the baby's going to start crying and we don't want that on the podcast. But she said, you say you love me, dang it. And so I'm saying I love my wife publicly.
Wow.
Here on this microphone.
Oh, my God.
This was
a huge
after
thing.
This was after I had said, you know, we maybe shouldn't have gotten married. But like, there's a baby. We're
right.
You know,
what are you going to
baby.
Do? No, I
we
mean
love the baby too.
To think about like the dynamics of the parents, like we've talked about like Mitzi and Paul, but I think what the movie does so well is the slow dissolution of their marriage. Like the fact that we never really see them spar and argue with each other until the scene where like. The Chloe fight or the Chloe E scene where like they decide to
where
go and he's shooting
the
beach
table.
Day. Yeah.
Yeah.
But they're never ever fighting. It's just these small, like micro moments that we as the audience are picking up on, and we know obviously through Sammy. But the whole point of like the dissolution of their marriage is just like this slow burnout and like her realizing, him realizing, and not wanting to face the music ultimately of like what's playing out in front of them, both the Bach music that plays when Sammy discovers it, but also, you know, their relationship
literally facing the music. Yeah. There's this movie has this sort of interesting undercurrent of like 50s America house picket fence to have kids, and a lot of it is very like gender stereotypical. You definitely get the idea. I know the Blank Check episode on the Fablemans covers this like very well, but about how Bert and Mitzi were sort of together because that's just sort of what you did at the time, and that they're not a good fit for each other. And I think that it's really interesting to look at kind of like American heteronormativity as the real villain of this movie, but also something that is the you know, onus for a lot of divorce and the sort of like just slow, upsetting, not quite explosive, but not really like they don't love each other enough to be able to stick together.
Right. And like the fact that they become friends later in life is so telling. Like they're good friend partners for each other, but they're not soulmate lovers for each other.
Yeah.
And like that's ultimately like what drives them apart. Like she just doesn't love him like she loves Bert.
To be clear, that's extra textual information. We don't find out they become friends, and that's just
true.
We know that to be true about Sammy Fableman's real parents.
Yeah. So, sorry, I should have said
that's
that.
That's okay. I think the scene after the hallway scene is another of my favorites, where he goes home and he talks with his mom, and it's Michelle Williams' last scene in the film. She exits the movie after that, and I think that scene is the one that really crystallized for me that this is a very broadly queer film, because she says, you don't owe anybody your life, not even me, which is a thing for the mother who gave birth to you to tell you, you know. The second time I saw this movie, I watched it with my biological mother, who I've become very close to in recent years. And I was holding my baby, and my biological mother was sitting next to me, and Mitzi Fabelman said, "You don't owe anybody your life, not even me." And I almost started like weeping, but like, I think there is something. So I sort of broadly define queerness as anything that pushes back against the cis heteronormative family structure is a little bit queer.
A little bit.
So like your child striking out on their own and not necessarily having space for their family of origin is not like super queer, but it's a little bit queer. Like you see this a lot, this idea of the chosen family, the family, you know, the family, the found family or whatever you want to call it. A lot of like cis het people are falling into that space because it like makes more sense to them than, you know, sticking with a family of origin that doesn't understand or respect them, especially in this era when our country has become so crazy polarized. The world has become so crazy polarized. Like there is, that is a little bit queer. The idea of the chosen family emerged from the queer community and is now like everywhere in society, including on the television show Ted Lasso. But like, you know, there's also sort of the fact that if Mitzi, Bert, and Benny had just had a polyamorous triad, that would have solved a lot of problems.
Yeah.
No, for real though. That scene that is like weirdly upsetting and just a little bit too sexy.
When she's dancing.
Well, that one. But I was mostly talking when they're trying to pull off her acrylic nails.
Oh, the nail cut.
The piano performance. Is uncomfortable because you're like, I see how the three of them work well together.
Right.
And it doesn't feel like one woman between two men. It feels like three people that have to fit into a two-person structure because we say so.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So like that idea of like non-monogamy, a little bit queer, like all of these, this whole movie is about how this family structure that we prize above everything else in our culture stagnates people. It suffocates them. It holds them in place. And like, but anytime you try to find an escape from that, it's demonized. And Kushner understands this. I'm not sure Spielberg does, but queerness is inherently an escape from that. Queerness is inherently a pressure release valve on the pressures of this imagined conceit that we invented 200 years ago. And we're like, this is how life is supposed to be. And everyone was just like, okay, I guess. And so like the queer undercurrent of this is so much in the fact that like there is an allure to a life that isn't that. Even if it's just like, you kind of want to also sleep with your best friend and sleep with your wife and maybe all three of you at the same time together. Wouldn't that be fun? But you can't do that because that's not how society works. But like, why isn't it?
Why
couldn't that be the way? Why couldn't these three just have a nice time together? They would have been so happy as a throuple.
And why isn't there room to try that, decide, you know, not for me, and then revert back to what you did. I think like in the same way that queerness is a pressure release valve, it's freedom, and it is space to explore in the way that kind of like cis heteronormativity like implicitly isn't space to explore. It's space to say, we know who you are and you will follow that, as opposed to being like, why don't you try it and see that everything is a possibility to you.
Yeah.
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 I feel like Jeannie Berlin's character honestly kind of picks up on it. Like during those early dinner conversations with them, like her character is very much kind of calling out the throuple nature to their dynamic. And like everyone just sort of skirts around. It's like, oh no, they're just my best friend. Uncle is just an endearing term, et cetera, et cetera. So like the conversation and like the way in which it's being felt is clearly had by all, but no one's able to like actually like pierce the specifics of the conversation and the reasons why these things are happening within the family dynamic.
I think that I, as an extreme Gentile, should not develop a Janie Berlin impression, but I wish I had one. She's got one all-time great voice.
God, she's so fucking good.
All-time great.
What a wonderful side eye with the paper plates.
Yes.
And the plastic tablecloth. First of all, brilliant. But secondly, I have the type of family who would definitely have an aneurysm if we went to someone's house and that was the way that they operated their dinner. I felt Janie Berlin's side eye very strongly during those scenes.
Okay, note to self, never have paper plates in home when Brooke comes over.
I don't care.
She's incredible. We haven't even like really talked about it, but like the scientist versus artist thing, I think, Emily, I was thinking about that while you were talking, and it's like, my family is very much that as well. Like growing up, it was always like, you're either a scientist or science, math, or art. And like, there's no in between. And I think that like, if we're talking about like breaking like the heteronormative structures or just structures in general, like while that is just like a thing that you do, I think there is this like forced roles in which we as society like have to play. And I think like, even though like it's science versus art versus what you do for your career or your life, it is like these constant holes that Sammy Fableman is pushed into, and like these roles that you have to play within like American like het society. It's just like everything like within this movie is all about like pushing people into specific boxes without like engaging with the conversations there.
I am fascinated by this because like there is this archetypal thing in American culture of the son who wants to be an artist and the father who's like, you got to get a career or you got to play football or whatever.
Mm.
And that's queer coded. Why? Mm.
Yeah.
There are all kinds of straight guy artists, musicians, filmmakers, whatever. And yet every time we tell their story, that's this queer coded thing. The father is worried that the son... It's because it's this like tiny aberration from what is supposed to be. And like the second you start sort of like looking at that, it's just kind of everywhere. We're like recording this at a time when dozens of states around the country are trying to outlaw queer identities in children, are trying to say kids should not hear about queerness. Kids should not be permitted to like explore their gender identity. The idea of a child, you know, of your assigned male at birth child trying on she, her pronouns at school for a while, even if they like revert away from that, they're like, I don't, you know, that's not me, like, is so threatening because of all of these things. This idea of like, we have solved for life and we know how it works and we know how it's supposed to work. And anytime you break from that by a millimeter, mm-hmm. we're going to police that heavily, is so core to American life.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's weird that this movie is about that. And yet I'm so glad it is.
100%.
Yeah. And I think like there's two off of that point. There's two very like interesting elements of Paul Dano as Bert Fableman that sort of like both uphold that sort of, well, why this is not a hobby, this is a real career that I like. One is that he's a good dad. He is a sweet guy. Like he really cares about his kids. He's not a super macho, super no emotions guy. Like he's really like a good person. And I think that being able to show that this idea of no, you have to follow the path comes for everyone. It doesn't just come for the people who refuse to look inward and refuse to ever be weak in any way, shape, or form. Like, it comes for all of you. And again, the idea of freedom and the idea that like, well, I wasn't allowed to deviate, so why should you be allowed to deviate? Are you telling me that I could have deviated this whole time and I just didn't, and now it's too late?
It's the center of America's political culture the whole time I've been alive. It wasn't always. There was a time when American political culture was so much more about like building a collective will to do things. But so much of it has been like, here's a totally non-queer thing. The forgiveness of student loan debt. There's so many people who are like, well, I didn't get my loans forgiven. Right. Why should this idea that like it's a Manichean struggle for everybody to just do the best they can and you all stay on the same path and the person who comes the furthest wins. Queerness doesn't have space for that idea. That's kind of the one thing queerness doesn't have space for. Certainly there are fucking queer capitalists and, you know, a lot of like very powerful queer people who have pushed ahead or whatever. But like inherently within queerness, there is sort of this idea of like, we kind of have to take care of our own because nobody else will.
Right.
And like, that's why it's such a threat to that whole fucking political project that has defined my life as long as I've been alive.
Yeah. I think on your Burt call out, I think was really strong too. And I think what's fascinating, if you look at, unfortunately, Steven Spielberg's life, is how angry he was in like the portrayal of father figures and mother figures throughout his filmography. And I think what's so beautiful about this movie is it's like really takes a step back and looks at his parents as people, which we were talking about is like a big thing to realize. But like there is a humanism to this, and like Burt is, they're such textured characters. Like they're not one dimensional. It's not a one dimensional bad dad. Yeah, exactly.
He's so great.
Like he does want the best for his son, but he does keep calling his son's love a hobby. And it's like not like trying to struggle with that. I think that's what makes the last scene so impactful too, is like when he's like, I could have gotten it sooner, or maybe I should have done X, Y, or Z, but you're doing this. So like, yes, okay, drop out of school. And it's like being able to like finally make that realization. And Spielberg, I think, earlier in his life, not being able to like step back and see the good or bad that his parents were having and the nuances about this, and now being able to look back all these years later and actually recognize like, oh, okay, my parents are humans. There are good and bad things that happen. How do we like struggle with these feelings that we're having?
I feel like all of human life is just coming to grapple with the fact that your parents were shitty about certain things, whether they were the best parents ever or the worst parents ever. You just like, and then you, I think the second, like right before you die, you're like, oh yeah. And then they just died and I'm going to die too. And like, now that I have a kid, realizing that my kid is going to do the same, my kid is always going to see me as this like person that they are defined against. Mm-hmm. And like, they are never going to entirely see me as human until I'm dead. And that's fun. I'm glad of that. But you know what? I have a really cute baby. And
that's that is true. Yeah, no, that's true.
It's this idea that there's no possible way to be flawless for your kids. It is never possible for your kids to not be angry or upset or resentful about something or other, even if they have nothing but love for you. You can't, because you're human. And that's a crazy thing to deal with.
We talked about earlier about how the four-year-old brain just will interpret things. And like, mm-hmm. so much that's going to be filtered through your parents. It is inevitable.
Right.
There's an anecdote in the book, The Body Keeps the Score, which like 10 billion people have read at this point. But the anecdote is basically, the Dr. Vanderkolk, who's the person who wrote the book, is watching this mother hold her baby, and the baby reaches out and yanks on the mother's hair, which is a thing that babies do. I really should cut this hair off. I don't know why I'm dealing, but the baby reaches out and yanks on the hair, and the mom is taken by surprise, and she acts in a way that scares the baby. Hmm. And the baby enters this space of like rejection. Hmm. And is like, oh no, my mother no longer loves me. And then the mother calms the baby and everything. But that split second, you don't know like what neural pathway that got stuck in. And that's like a totally natural human reaction to someone pulling on your hair.
Right.
But because of the power dynamic inherent in the parent-child relationship, it becomes so much more fraught.
Mm-hmm. Watching your parents come into their own as real people who aren't in love with each other, and mm-hmm. being able to only process that through the fact that you're going to make a movie about this someday.
Yeah.
Because that is what your brain can handle. It's crazy.
Because you needed to have a laugh.
Being alive is wild.
Being alive. Oh. My God.
Listen, what is queerer than buying a monkey? Let's just kind of leave it there.
Michelle Williams so camp in this movie.
It's unbelievable.
What a great movie.
God. Any other scenes, moments?
This is a movie of moments, so...
Would you say movies are moments?
Movies are dreams.
I love that the whole beginning of this movie is the bifurcation. Like, this is a film, and films are 24 frames a second. And if you put those together, there's the persistence of vision. And
movies are art! Movies are everything!
She's like, it's a dream.
I love it. It's great. And I think it sets the scene and the movie up very well. No, I think... I don't know.
We give enough to Judd Hirsch, the way he says pachyderm.
Nominated for that Oscar, baby.
I will say the one scene I don't like, which is, I don't think it's a bad scene. I think it's the one scene that is kind of on the nose. It's when Sam's watching working on his movie, and his sister comes in and she's distraught, and they're talking and they're crying. And then she says, "You're the most like mom of any of us." I'm like, I buy she would say that in that moment. That's why I don't think it's a bad scene. I think that a child that age having that revelation is like totally real. I kind of just bumps me out of the movie for like 5 seconds because I'm like, I have already realized this as an astute movie watcher. But
I feel like that scene then gets me back though when he can't, like how he processes, like he's just working on his movie and she's like, how the fuck are you able to do this after what we just went through? And it's like, I don't know, but it's all I do know, and like, let me cook. And it's the most
let me cook.
It's just so relatable because like, it's his escape, and like that is art is our escape. And it's interesting that he then explored that further in Sammy Fableman, of course, in the movie Let Me Go If You Can, about his relationship with his dad. So, you know, I think it was fascinating to put that there, these kernels. So
And David Lynch has like the best cameo.
God, he's so fucking incredible.
Top 10 cameos of all time.
Storms in with smooches.
I love that he has the fuck. And I think Spielberg.
Can you do the fuck?
If the horizon's in the middle, it's boring as shit. Get the fuck out of my office.
Beautiful.
People have done it better. I'm not one of those people.
You sound like David Lynch. What do you mean?
It's boring as shit.
Right. You really gotta go high and weird.
But not too high.
You know what? My voice training to help me talk more like a lady gave me a great David Lynch. So I'm just gonna give it a shot. I'm just gonna give it a shot.
Oh my gosh, here we go.
I can only do the weather report though. All right. Okay. Well, it's Thursday in Los Angeles, and today the weather's gonna be sunny. If the horizon's at the top of the picture, it's interesting. Horizon at the bottom of the picture, interesting. Horizon in the middle, it's boring as shit. Now get the fuck out of my office.
That's good. Woo-hoo! That's pretty good.
Yes.
Wow.
You win.
Weirdly, it also gave me a good Harrison Ford, but that one comes and goes.
He's tough too.
Harrison Ford was in a Sammy Fableman picture. I hope we all remember.
Yes.
Yeah.
Are you gonna
Levers of the Lost Ark?
Get out of here!
I thought it was so cool that in the Spielbergs, Harrison Ford played William Wyler at the end. I thought that.
Thought that was a really interesting metatextual piece of casting. This is a good movie. Everyone watch it if you haven't. Rank up that VOD because I just got to tell you, this movie didn't actually
do that well.
It technically made back its budget, but we all know that budgets aren't really real. It was made for $40 million, a $40 million therapy session, and it made $40 million at the box office.
I have been led to believe it was pretty big on VOD. I suspect it will make its money back and probably turn a nice little profit, but it was very much part of that movement of nobody's going to adult movies anymore, that came up in November that everybody freaked out about, that I think indirectly led to Everything Everywhere All at Once winning Best Picture. It won it on its own merits. It was a movie people loved, but it definitely like caused people to go take a second look at that movie because it had been such a sensation earlier in the year.
Yes. So.
This movie cracked 1,000 theaters, but not by much, I got to say. And it never even got into the top five.
I want to say that this movie and Everything Everywhere All at Once are kind of in conversation. They're both about realizing your parents are people. They're both about like your parents realizing how they've hurt you. And like, I feel like the Fablemans has more of a bird's eye view of it because that's just, you know, where Steven Spielberg is in his life. And it's not quite where the Daniels are in their lives. By the way, our baby calls us the mothers, like the Daniels. They are very much, they're in conversation in a fun
definitely.
Way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that they both are these sort of profound artistic pieces of filmmaking. Like, it really does feel like Everything Everywhere, it didn't need to win Best Picture to do this, but it fully has cemented its place in like the film canon. And I think that the Fablemans, like much of Spielberg's work, but specifically this movie, is going to be a movie that people look back on and are like, holy shit.
I think it's just this late period Spielberg is so fascinating, and people are so quick to write him off for schmaltz, and it's so frustrating with just this movie because it's so not that. So if you think that this movie is going to be that, go into it with an open mind. Yeah. It'll knock your freaking socks off.
But also, if you kind of want like a schmaltzy movie about the power of the movies, it does deliver on that in a certain way, in that when I was watching this, I was like,
movies are dreams.
But it's so much more than that.
Yeah.
I feel like people deride Spielberg for schmaltz a lot in the 21st century. And like, obviously he has some schmaltzy movies. War Horse, I mean, not my favorite Spielberg, I'll just put it mildly. I like The Post, but it is pretty schmaltzy. It is pretty Aaron Sorkin-y. Mm. Yeah.
I really liked Sammy Fableman's version of War Horse, which was War Dog. I don't know if you remember that. It wasn't War Dogs. Really, it competed in the same year
and
as War Dogs.
Also not to be confused with Dog.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, but sometimes you need a little schmaltz, and it's okay.
And it's fine, you know, and I think he's only made two movies in the 2020s, but they're West Side Story and The Fablemans, and they're both bangers.
They're both fucking incredible.
Hasn't lost his fastball. What's your top five? What's your top five Spielberg?
Yeah, so I was just looking at it. I think I want to move some. So I think honestly, my top 14 are all kind of some of my favorite movies of all time. Shockingly, Steven Spielberg makes good movies. What I have now is Jurassic Park, E.T., Schindler, Jaws. Here's my hot take. I have Last Crusade at number five. I think I like Last Crusade more than Raiders.
Literally insane of you, but whatever.
The daddy issues for me really work, shockingly.
It's the daddy issues.
It's the daddy issue movie. Catch Me If You Can, Fablemans, West Side, Lincoln.
So that's
AI,
your top 10.
Saving, Minority, Tintin. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So your number 10 is Lincoln. And your Fablemans is currently sitting at number 8.
Yeah. But that's going to be, I think, moving up. I also haven't rewatched the Indiana Jones movies in a while. I am wearing an Indiana Jones shirt. But those were my favorite movies growing up alongside Star Wars. But I need to rewatch before this new one to like really refresh. But if I'm ever really down bad and depressed, I'll watch Last Crusade. It's kind of like a perfect bomb of a movie.
Yeah, I think that if people were like, what's the franchise that you want to make, you want to write an entry for, I would say Indiana Jones, like in a heartbeat.
What are your five?
I mean, I want to write Fablemans too. I'm just going to be honest about that.
Fablemans too. I think
my number one's AI. I went and saw that in theaters at the Academy Museum last year.
Oof.
And it was it's a brilliant movie, and B, it was when it really crystallized for me that it was kind of Spielberg's first therapy movie.
Yeah,
it's very much him being like, my whole deal's kind of fucked up, right? Let's talk about that. I think AI is my number one.
So
I
good.
Think
I'm shocked you didn't say A and I. For your points, not A and B.
Honestly, Emily, kind of problematic of you to, you know, since you're teaching your baby to hate AI.
Yeah, that's
to have
true.
Your
actually,
movie
yeah,
about
let's cancel
AI.
Emily for that.
Something to think about.
Oh, yeah, my kid's gonna cancel me over that. I think my number two is probably E.T.
Yeah.
Fucking adore E.T. After that, I think I would go Jaws.
Yeah.
And after that, I do love the Indiana Jones movies. I'm not sure that one of them stands out in a way where I'm like those were my favorite movies growing up. I'm not sure one of them stands out in a way where I'm like, yeah, I got to put that up there. So after that, I think, God, there's so many good ones. I know my number five is Munich, so I'm just kind of
saving it.
Yeah, but I think I'm going to say Close Encounters. I think that run, including 1941, which is messy but fun, is just so, so good. Jaws through fucking E.T. is impeccable.
I mean, the man has made a lot of fucking incredible movies.
Yeah.
So
I feel like I have to see, I feel like I have to be a little bit more of a Spielberg completist than I am right now. But if I'm going to say my top five, I would say Raiders number one with the bullet. Then Jurassic Park. Then I think Catch Me If You Can. I think that movie is
fucking perfect movie.
So incredible. I think that I would put Jaws number four and then Tintin at number five.
Tintin's
great. I love that movie so much.
The BFG?
No, but I would put Duel, I think, pretty high.
Duel's
great.
I also really like 15.
Yeah.
I will say that when I was thinking about what I wanted to put it forth, Fablemans kept popping up.
I
suspect that will move into my top five.
I think that might go to five right now, honestly. I think
I might do
the swap.
This is my prediction. Steven Spielberg is obviously, both of his parents live to be over 100, so he's going to be with us for many years to come. I think when he dies, this movie will be very high up in his obituary.
Yes.
That's my prediction.
I would agree. You know what, though? I will say Lincoln deserves more talk. I think that it's such a fucking incredible movie. And people, like, shove that movie aside for some reason.
Well, it kind of depends what Spielberg you're in the mood for, you know? True. Like, there are a lot of different modes of Spielberg, yeah. And you can pick what your preference is.
Right.
See, I like
Sammy Fableman.
I like my Tintin, you know? I like a good action adventure. Mm-hmm. And it's so rare that we get them. So, yeah. But, like, Lincoln, if you want, like, really incredible, like, serious prestige, like, just solid filmmaking.
Tommy Lee Jones so ham-hocking about.
There's this thing where people feel like Spielberg has won way more Oscars than he has. And yes. Obviously the man has 2 directing Oscars, 1 Best Picture Oscar. I'm not saying he doesn't have, you know, if he never wins another Oscar, he's been properly, you know, celebrated. But he hasn't won that many Oscars.
No, no.
Objectively speaking, like, and his movies in the 21st century have won 4 total across all of them. And they've gotten so many nominations and they keep getting blanked or they win 1 award or whatever. And it's like, but people have this, there was this perception coming in where it was like, well, Fableman's, well, Spielberg, he's won so many Oscars. The same thing happened to Lincoln,
yeah.
Where weirdly Argo became this like, oh, that we should vote for the little scrappy movie that could. And it's like, okay, but I think Lincoln's aged way better than Argo. I don't hate Argo, but Lincoln's amazing.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I feel the same.
Yeah.
Well, should we see how people feel about this movie?
Well, this is a little nerve-wracking.
I will say this is pretty high up in like the how many people have seen Spielberg's ours. Movies. Yeah. Would you like to guess the average Letterboxd rating?
I have.
Jordan Guess.
I'm going to see. I think people like it. I don't know if people are as in the tank for it as I might be. I know I'm very biased, but I'm gonna guess like a 3.7.
Okay. Emily, would you care to put in a guess?
I actually looked at this pretty recently, although I'm sure it's fluctuated. It was like a 3.8 when I looked at it.
I have good news and bad news for both of you. The bad news is that neither of you are correct, but the good news is that the Letterboxd average for this film is a 4.1.
Oh shit.
What?
People Whoa. Like this
Let's
movie.
Let's go, Steven.
It was like hovering right under 4 when I checked. It was at 3.9. And I was like, I bet as more people watch it, it's trended. Because that's
Hell
generally
yeah.
what happens. That
yeah.
it's trended up is great.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
It's chilling at a 4.1. We've got 330,000 people that have watched it. And lots of reviews, 106,000, which is, I feel like, a lot
it's
for
a
movie that is kind of, you know.
Quiet, yeah.
Quiet. But I think to your VOD point, Emily, people are discovering this and are very happy about it.
Yeah.
It's a movie that plays beautifully at home, as much as Steven Spielberg would hate to hear me say that. It's like it plays beautifully on a television. You
yeah.
know?
No, I mean, the 4K, I will say, looks great.
Did you buy
it? Great BTS.
Did you get it in time?
Sitting right there, baby.
Jordan bought physical media copy of The Fablemans for this episode.
Oh, shit. I just got a deadline alert. Sam Fableman is attached to direct Ready Player 2.
Oh, no. Oh,
okay. Passing the torch.
Wow, we love to yeah. see that.
Wow.
I'm sure that movie will be as good.
I was just going to say, I need to become a Spielberg completist, but if I was making my list, Ready Player 1 would probably be maybe dead last. If
wow.
not, I hate that movie.
Ready Player 1. Was the first movie I saw after I admitted I was a woman. And there had always been a tiny voice in the back of my brain that was screaming at every movie, when does the girl get something to do? But I was letting her like drive the car at that point. I saw that movie with Phil Iskove,
hey.
My co-host on 92. And I watched it, and that is a movie where the girl gets nothing to do.
No.
And that voice was like, is this how all movies are? And I was like, I guess, kind of. And yeah, so that's always my experience of Ready Player One, which my friend David Sims sticks up for.
Yes.
Is just
does.
Like remembering watching that movie and being like, is Olivia Cooke going to like, or is she just going to be there to like.
Is she going to cook?
Yeah.
They did not let her cook.
But that Shining sequence does rule.
I don't.
It's pretty
give
good.
A
yeah.
fuck.
It's a good Shining sequence.
I saw that movie at probably the most unbearable time in my life for seeing women do things in films, which was sophomore year to senior year of college, where I was like, I just am so full of rage all the time. And if I don't get to see a woman punch someone in the face in this blockbuster, I'm going to be mad about it.
Was this your Jessica Chastain as a spy era?
Yes. And also my seeing Atomic Blonde like 6 times in theaters. It was it was like three times in theaters. But listen, I had a lot of feelings and I didn't know how to express them.
Similar to Sammy Fableman.
I was pretty mad at Ready Player One. I gotta say.
I'm younger than you. I'm amazed at how young you are.
Yeah, so. I know.
I am younger than you. Let's just be clear about that.
No, that is true.
And I my goal was to be a mentor for you as
thank you.
Older and wiser.
You're doing so well.
Thank you so much. All right. Well, that's how Letterboxd feels. Aren't we all so happy? But how do we feel?
Ooh, where is this landing?
Is this landing on the QQ? I mean, I'm not going to do anything crazy.
Five.
You want to do something crazy, you go for it. I'm going to give it 3.5 stars on the QQ, which is pretty high for a movie that is ostensibly not about anything queer at all. When I told my lovely fiance Evan that we were covering this today, he was like, "What?" And I was like, "Just wait, just listen.
Let us cook.
So yeah, I'm gonna give it 3.5 stars.
Ooh,
on the
interesting.
QQ. I think this was a really wonderful discussion.
Yeah. No, I'll mirror you. Fuck it. Why not? 3.5. Yeah. Okay. That feels right.
Wow, we're a real Steven Spielberg, Sam and Fableman duo.
The duality here.
Emily. What do you think?
Using my more expansive definition of queerness as anything that pushes back against cis heteronormativity, I'm giving it a 4. I think it is very much, it hasn't entirely unlocked itself from thinking about life in those cis heteronormative terms, but it is very much questioning why the fuck do we do things this way in a productive, thoughtful fashion. And also, Sammy Fableman famously thinks boys are hot. So
that's true.
Famously.
Yeah, in 1942, Sammy Fableman made the, like, obviously the comedy, not 1941, 1942, the sequel to it. And it's a bunch of hot boys just in war. And, like, they start kissing and they're, you know, shooting people. And, like, as you were saying earlier, people that didn't get it at the time. But now that we're looking back, we're like, 1942 is a queer masterpiece.
It's amazing what queer art has to undergo to really be acknowledged. So some thoughts that we need to take away. Why are the John Wick movie so straight? When will John Wick get to kiss a man? And when will Sammy Fableman be recognized by being the Grand Marshal of WeHo Pride at the age of 19? Because he is perpetually 19. Those are my thoughts.
I do have one last thing.
Yes.
I feel like the John Williams score is incredible in this.
It's great.
It's so fucking good, and it doesn't kick in until like 30 minutes in the movie. It takes so long for the score to start. It's crazy.
He's too busy experiencing movies that are dreams.
That's true. Yeah.
That cute kid. He's so cute.
That kid is adorable.
Real Spielberg.
The casting is insane. How close they look.
Yeah, and it's everyone's kind of mad about the eye color, and I'm like, guys, I thought we all agreed to just chill on the eye color thing. It happens all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's just chill. Just chill, everybody. Chill.
Eyes are
dreams.
We don't
want to put kids in. We've all read Jeanette McCurdy's book. Don't put contacts on that kid.
Yeah.
Leave him alone. I saw the musical Secret Garden here in LA. And after reading Jeanette McCurdy's book, I was like, how are these children being mistreated? I need to get to the bottom. I have no evidence of that. They all seem like they're having a nice time and a nice life in their Instagram accounts or whatever. Like, but I just like now every time I see a child performer, I'm like, oh my God, this is a horrible thing. We should only have adults play children.
We really should. When I was 12 years old, I wanted nothing more than to be on Disney Channel. It was my life goal. And reading Jeanette McCurdy's book, I was like, I am so glad I had parents who were like, absolutely not. Speaking of getting to know your parents as real people, like, yeah. Anyway, this is a good movie.
That was beautiful.
It's a good movie. And Emily, I will thank you so much for recommending this. When you send us an email, subject title, The Emily Mins.
Yeah.
We were delighted.
That was immediately after I had seen it with my mom. And I was like, this movie is very queer.
You like, got to chat like, about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're very lucky to have you here to chat about it.
Yes. I love coming on this show because, again, you let me be chaotic in a way where I'm like, I can just be like, you know what? There's this famous moment in John Wick when John Wick says, yeah, I'm thinking I'm back. And in John Wick 5, he should say, yeah, I'm thinking I'm gay now. And then it should just be about him dating men. Like,
I think
it should
that's
just
a good call.
Be a rom-com.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been waiting for gay John Wick. Why not make it John Wick?
Right.
Exactly.
Come on, stop thinking so hard. Listen, I feel like I always think about movies so radically differently through a much richer queerer text after we get the chance to talk to you. Mm-hmm. So know we're a fan of you as much as you're a fan of
Thank you.
To be chaotic on air.
I will definitely come back. And if you have more like theme months or something coming up, let me know. Or I'll just be like, hey, let's fucking talk War Horse. Let's find out what's so clear about that horse.
We're all, basically every movie is on the table. But
that's true. Like Empire of the Moon, Sammy Fableman's classic hit film.
Okay. Emily, you're doing a lot of really cool things. What are you up to? Where can people find you? Tell us more about this novel.
You can find me on Twitter. I still have to do Twitter. Now that I'm a freelancer, Twitter is more important than ever. And I fucking hate it, right? Because I want to get more off Twitter. But I'm on Twitter at Emily St. Jams. I'm on Mastodon at M St. James. I'm on all sorts of platforms if you want to go looking for me. I am freelance writing. I had a piece go up in the New York Times. I'm doing weekly pieces on Succession at Vulture.
Yeah.
And have some other shit in the hopper.
Have you seen any of the new season?
Yes, I have. I've just seen the premiere. I know if you want to know a really big spoiler, I'll tell you one off mic. But
no,
you don't want to know?
But okay. Positive or negative?
The premiere's fantastic.
Yeah.
I really loved it. I'm really excited for where this season's going. Some other critics have told me some stuff that's coming up, and I'm just like agog. I co-host podcasts like It's 1992, which you can find on platforms everywhere. You two were on our single white female episode where we talked about queerness being fish food flakes.
Yes. <That's>
true. Does Spielberg have a 92 movie or is he just cooking in the hopper for his big 93?
That is right between Hook in 91 and then his 93 of Jurassic
his
Park.
His big year.
Schindler's. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Is so that the best year ever for a filmmaker?
Probably. Like you'd have to go back to like the Capra era when people were routinely making multiple films a year.
God damn, Jesus.
Yeah. It's a fun show. We're talking about all the movies of 1992. At some point I will convince Phil that we should be talking about movies of the 2000s because nostalgia has moved on to that point. I love the 90s too, but like I was looking at the list of movies that came out in 2001 and I was like, we got to do it. We got to fucking do it. 2001's such a good year.
It's a really good year.
All you have to do is wait another 5 years and then you can do podcasts like it's 2001.
Isn't 2001 Shrek year?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. 2001's a great year.
Well, you're on the Shrek episode, so that's
great.
Jordan will be doing that one alone.
What? Hey, now you're not an all star.
That's actually Sammy Fableman's cover.
That's true.
All star.
I remember that. Yeah, it went because when obviously Katzenberg and Spielberg, you know, worked on DreamWorks
together, they hired Fableman. I can't do this.
I have the podcast Arden, which I'm not as involved with, but our third season is currently in production. Their third season, I should say. I'm not actively working on it. I'm just writing an episode, but it's a good show. You should go back and listen to it. The first two seasons are great.
It's great.
I'm working on some book projects. I'm working on some other projects. Hopefully this novel will sell. And I tell you what, when it does, the first thing I'm going to do is come on Queer Quadrant and reveal everything about it.
Yes.
We'll save a spot for you. We promise. Yeah,
absolutely.
Can't wait. Love it. We're not as exciting, but we are.
No, we are not.
Unfortunately, on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Brooke B. Solomon.
Jordan Hitchcuss.
And we're together at Queer Quadrant. And the same thing goes for Instagram and for Letterboxd. And you can find the podcast on Spotify, on Apple, and wherever else you get your podcast. Drop us a rate if you like. Five Fablemans only. Five film reels only. A review about how homoerotic this movie is. Subscribe if you feel like it. And you can also tweet at us, but be nice, please. And tell us what you want us to see us cover in the future.
And Brooke, what are we covering in the future?
This is a very exciting announcement. This is another similarly, you might be saying, Brooke, that Jordan, that film is so straight. No, the fuck it's not.
Shut the fuck up.
Next week for a anniversary episode, or 2 weeks from now, I guess I should say, we are covering Down with Love.
Oh, my God.
Simply one of the best movies of all time.
One of the greatest, yeah.
Cannot wait to talk about it.
Sammy Fableman was a big proponent of that movie. He was like there at the premiere. He was really vocal about trying to
and
get
you know,
it more
maybe
Oscar noms.
Spielberg had actually joined him.
That's true.
We could have gotten that movie recognition instead of it being a flop.
No, yeah. It would have made money. Yeah.
But tune in the next 2 weeks for that. Jordan, anything you want to leave the listeners with?
I mean, I just think we all should remember that Sammy Fableman is our greatest living queer filmmaker. If you just go to his IMDb, just take a scroll down Fableman Lane.
Yep.
What's your favorite Fableman?
My favorite Fableman movie.
Joint, yeah.
Prehistoric Park.
Ooh.
There's a reason I'm not a comedy podcaster.
My pitch on that was Jurassic Ark, which was about the other Ark that wasn't Noah's Ark that was full of dinosaurs and everybody died.
And that seems that's good. Like a Brooke Solomon movie, so we're going to go with that.